Fiction concluded that these Donchant books had all spread from a central location, and so there's nothing to learn by where they ended up. Fiction was a bootlicker, not a scholar, Elista said. Look, there's easy proof here that the same writing system was once used all across Roshar. I have references in Makabakam, Selatales, Alethala. Not a diaspora of texts, but real evidence they wrote naturally in the Donchant.
You suppose they all spoke the same language?
Hardly.
But Yasna Kolin's relic and monument?
Doesn't claim everyone spoke the same language, only that they wrote it. It's foolish to assume that everyone used the same language across hundreds of years and dozens of nations. It makes more sense that there was a codified written language, the language of scholarship, just like you'll find many undertexts written in Alethi now.
Ah, he said. And then a desolation hit.
Elista nodded, showing him a later page in her sheaf of notes. This in-between weird language is where people started using the Donchant script to phonetically transcribe their language. It didn't work so well. She flipped two more pages. In this scrap, we have one of the earliest emergences of the proto-Thalo-Voran glyphic radicals, and here's one showing a more intermediate Thalan form. We've always wondered what happened to the Dawn chant. How could people forget how to read their own language? Well, it seems clear now. By the point this happened, the language had been moribund for millennia. They weren't speaking it and hadn't been for generations.
Brilliant, Irv said.
He wasn't so bad. For a Siln.
I've been translating what I can but got stuck on the Kovad fragment. If what you've been doing here is correct, it might be because Kovad isn't true Dawn chant, but a phonetic transcription of another ancient language.
He glanced to the side, then cocked his head. Was he looking at her? Oh, no. It was just the book, which she was still sitting on.
An accountability of virtue, he grunted. Good book.
You've read it?
I have a fondness for Alethi epics, he said absently, flipping through her pages. She really should have picked Vadam, though. Sterling was a flatterer and a cadger.
Sterling is a noble and upright officer, she narrowed her eyes. And you are just trying to get a rise out of me, Ardent Irv.
Maybe.
He flipped through her pages, studying a diagram she'd made of various Donchant grammars.
I have a copy of the sequel.
There's a sequel?
About her sister.
The mousy one?
She is elevated to courtly attention and has to choose between a strapping naval officer, a Thalan banker, and the king's wit.
Wait. There are three different men this time?
Sequels always have to be bigger, he said,
then offered her the stack of pages back.
I'll lend it to you.
Oh, you will you? And what is the cost for this magnanimous gesture, Bright Lord Irv?
Your help, translating a stubborn section of Donchant. A particular patron of mine has a strict deadline upon its delivery.
Interlude 3. The Rhythm of the Lost. Venli attuned the rhythm of craving as she climbed down into the chasm. This wondrous new form, storm form, gave her hands a powerful grip, allowing her to hang hundreds of feet in the air, yet never fear that she would fall. The chitin plating under her skin was far less bulky than that of the old war form, but at the same time nearly as effective. During the summoning of the Everstorm, a human soldier had struck her directly across the face. His spear had cut her cheek and across the bridge of her nose, but the mask of chitin armor underneath had deflected the weapon. She continued to climb down the wall of stone, followed by Demid, her once mate, and a group of her loyal friends. In her mind she attuned the rhythm of command, a similar yet more powerful version of the rhythm of appreciation. Every one of her people could hear the rhythms, beats with some tones attached, yet she no longer heard the old common ones. Only these new, superior rhythms. Beneath her the chasm opened, where water from high storms had carved a bulge. She eventually reached the bottom, and the others dropped around her, each landing with a thumping crunch. Ulim moved down the stone wall. The spren usually took the form of rolling lightning, moving across surfaces. At the bottom, he formed from lightning into a human shape with odd eyes. Ulim settled on a patch of broken branches, arms folded, his long hair rippling in an unseen wind. She wasn't certain why a spren sent by Odium himself would look human.
"Around here, somewhere," Ulim said, pointing. "Spread out and search."
Venli set her jaw, humming to the rhythm of fury. Lines of power rippled up her arms. "Why should I continue to obey your orders, spren? You should obey me." The spren ignored her, which further stoked her anger. Demid, however, placed his hand on her shoulder and squeezed, humming to the rhythm of satisfaction.
"Come, look with me this way."
She curtailed her humming and turned south, joining Demid, picking her way through debris. Creme buildup had smoothed the floor of the chasm, but the storm had left a great deal of refuse. She attuned the rhythm of craving, a quick, violent rhythm.
"I should be in charge, Demid, not that spren."
"You are in charge."
"Then why haven't we been told anything? Our gods have returned, yet we've barely seen them. We sacrificed greatly for these forms, and to create the glorious true storm. We lost how many?"
Sometimes she thought about that, in strange moments when the new rhythms seemed to retreat. All of her work, meeting with Ulim in secret, guiding her people towards storm form. It had been about saving her people, hadn't it? Yet of the tens of thousands of listeners who had fought to summon the storm, only a fraction remained. Demid and she had been scholars, yet even scholars had gone to battle. She felt at the wound on her face.
"Our sacrifice was worthwhile," Demid told her to the rhythm of derision. "Yes, we have lost many, but humans sought our extinction. At least this way some of our people survived, and now we have great power."
He was right. And if she was being honest, a form of power was what she had always wanted. And she'd achieved one, capturing a spren in the storm within herself. That hadn't been one of Ulim's species, of course. Lesser spren were used for changing forms. She could occasionally feel the pulsing deep within of the one she'd bonded. In any case, this transformation had given her great power. The good of her people had always been secondary to Venli. Now was a late time to be having a bout of conscience. She resumed humming to craving. Demid smiled and gripped her shoulder again. They'd shared something once, during their days in mate form. Those silly, distracting passions were not ones they currently felt, nor were they something that any sane listener would desire. But the memories of them did create a bond. They picked through the refuse, passing several fresh human corpses, smashed into a cleft in the rock. Good to see those. Good to remember that her people had killed many, despite their losses.
"Venli," Demid said. "Look."
He scrambled over a log from a large wooden bridge that was wedged in the center of the chasm. She followed, pleased by her strength. She would probably always remember Demid as the gangly scholar he had been before this change, but she doubted either of them would ever willingly return. Forms of power were simply too intoxicating. Once across the log, she could see what Demid had spotted. A figure slumped by the wall of the chasm, helmeted head bowed. A shard blade, shaped like frozen flames, rose from the ground beside her, rammed into the stone floor.
"Eshanai, finally!"
Venli leaped from the top of the log, landing near Demid. Eshanai looked exhausted. In fact, she wasn't moving.
"Eshanai,"
Venli said, kneeling beside her sister.
"Are you well? Eshanai?"
She gripped the plated figure by the shoulders and lightly shook it. The head rolled on its neck, limp. Venli felt cold. Demid solemnly lifted Eshenai's faceplate, revealing dead eyes set in an ashen face.
Eshenai. No.
Ah, Ulim's voice said. Excellent.
The Spren approached across the stone wall like crackling lightning moving through the stone.
Demid, your hand.
Demid obediently raised his hand palm up, and Ulim shot across from the wall to the hand, then formed into his human shape, standing on the perch.
Hmm. Plate looks completely drained. Broken along the back, I see. Well, it's said to regrow on its own, even now that it is separated from its master from so long ago.
The plate, Venli said softly, numb. You wanted the plate.
Well, the blade, too, of course. Why else would we be hunting a corpse? You... Oh, you thought she was alive?
When you said we needed to find my sister, Venli said. I thought...
Yes, looks like she drowned in the storm's floodwaters,
Ulim said, making a sound like a tongue clicking.
Rammed the sword into the stone, held onto it to stay in place, but couldn't breathe.
Venli attuned the rhythm of the lost. It was one of the old inferior rhythms. She hadn't been able to find those since transforming, and she had no idea how she happened upon this one. The mournful, solemn tone felt distant to her.
Eshenai,
she whispered, and nudged the corpse again. Demid gasped. Touching the bodies of the fallen was taboo. The old songs spoke of days when humans had hacked apart listener corpses, searching for gem hearts. Leave the dead to peace instead. It was their way. Venli stared into Eshenai's dead eyes.
You were the voice of reason, Venli thought. You were the one who argued with me. You were supposed to keep me grounded. What do I do without you?
Well, let's get that plate off, kids, Ulim said.
Show respect, Venli snapped.
Respect for what? It's for the best that this one died.
For the best? Venli said. For the best?
She stood, confronting the little spren on Demid's outstretched palm.
That is my sister. She is one of our greatest warriors, an inspiration, and a martyr.
Ulim rolled his head in an exaggerated way, as if perturbed and bored by the chastisement.
How dare he? He was merely a spren. He was to be her servant. Your sister, Ulim said, didn't undergo the transformation properly. She resisted, and we'd have eventually lost her. She was never dedicated to our cause.
Venli attuned the rhythm of fury, speaking in a loud, punctuating sequence.
You will not say such things. You are spren. You are to serve.
And I do.
Then you must obey me.
You?
Ulim laughed.
Child, how long have you been fighting your little war against the humans? 3-4 years?
6 years, Spren, Demid said. 6 long, bloody years.
Well, do you want to guess how long we've been fighting this war?
Ulim asked.
Go ahead. Guess. I'm waiting.
Venli seethed. It doesn't matter.
Oh, but it does, Ulim said, his red figure electrifying. Do you know how to lead armies, Venli? True armies? Supply troops across a battlefront that spans hundreds of miles? Do you have memories and experiences that span eons?
She glared at him.
Our leaders, Ulim said, know exactly what they're doing. Them I obey. But I am the one who escaped. The spren of redemption. I don't have to listen to you.
I will be a queen, Venli said to Spite.
If you survive? Maybe. But your sister? She and the others sent that assassin to kill the human king specifically to keep us from returning. Your people are traitors, though your personal efforts do you justice, Venli. You may be blessed further, if you are wise. Regardless, get that armor off your sister, shed your tears, and get ready to climb back up. These plateaus are crawling with men who stink of honor. We must be away and see what your ancestors need us to do.
Our ancestors? Demid said. What do the dead have to do with this?
Everything, Ulim replied, seeing as they're the ones in charge. Armor. Now!
He zipped to the wall as a tiny streak of lightning, then moved off. Venli attuned derision at the way she'd been treated, then, defying taboos, helped Demid remove the shard plate. Ulim returned with the others and ordered them to gather up the armor. They hiked off, leaving Venli to bring the blade. She lifted it from the stone, then lingered, regarding her sister's corpse, which lay there in only padded underclothing. Venli felt something stir inside her. Again, distantly, she was able to hear the rhythm of the lost. Mournful, slow, with separated beats.
"Aye," Venli said. "Finally, I don't have to listen to you call me a fool. I don't have to worry about you getting in the way. I can do what I want."
That terrified her. She turned to go, but paused as she saw something. What was that small spren that had crept out from beneath Eshonai's corpse? It looked like a small ball of white fire. It gave off little rings of light and trailed a streak behind it, like a comet.
"What are you?" Venli demanded to Spite. "Shoo!"
She hiked off, leaving her sister's corpse there at the bottom of the chasm, stripped and alone. Food for either a chasm fiend or a storm. Shallan's Sketchbook, Urithiru.
The city is incredibly huge. A chasm fiend's back would not reach the fourth floor.
Part 2. New Beginnings, Sing. Shallan, Yasna, Dalinar, Bridge 4. 33. A Lecture. Dearest Sephandrius, I received your communication, of course.
Yasna was alive.
Yasna Kolin was alive! Shallan was supposed to be recovering from her ordeal, never mind that the bridgeman had handled the fighting. All she'd done was grope an eldritch spren. Still, she spent the next day holed up in her room, sketching and thinking. Yasna's return sparked something in her. Shallan had once been more analytical in her drawing, including notes and explanations with the sketches. Lately, she'd only been doing pages and pages of twisted images. Well, she'd been trained as a scholar, hadn't she? She shouldn't just draw. She should analyze, extrapolate, speculate. So she addressed herself to fully recording her experiences with the unmade. Adolin and Polona visited her separately, and even Dalinar came to check on her, while Navani clicked her tongue and asked after her health. Shallan endured their company, then eagerly returned to her drawing. There were so many questions. Why exactly had she been able to drive the thing away? What was the meaning of its creations? Hanging over her research, however, was a single daunting fact. Yasna was alive. Storms. Yasna was alive. That changed everything. Eventually, Shallan couldn't remain locked up any longer. Though Navani mentioned Yasna was planning to visit her later in the evening, Shallan washed and dressed, then threw her satchel over her shoulder and went searching for the woman. she had to know how Yasna had survived. In fact, as Shallan stalked the hallways of Urethiru, she found herself increasingly perturbed. Yasna claimed to always look at things from a logical perspective, but she had a flair for the dramatic to rival any storyteller. Shallan well remembered that night in Carbranth, when Yasna had lured thieves in, then dealt with them in stunning and brutal fashion. Yasna didn't want to merely prove her points. She wanted to drive them right into your skull with a flourish and a pithy epigram. Why hadn't she written via Spanreed to let everyone know she had survived? Storms, where had she been all this time? A few inquiries led Shallan back to the pit with its spiraling stairs. Guards in sharp Kolin blue confirmed that Yasna was below, so Shallan started trudging down those steps again, and was surprised to find that she felt no anxiety at the descent. In fact, the oppressive feelings she'd felt since they'd arrived at the tower seemed to have evaporated. No more fear, no more formless sense of wrongness. The thing she'd chased away had been its cause. Somehow its aura had pervaded the entire tower. At the base of the stairs, she found more soldiers. Dalinar obviously wanted this place well guarded. She certainly couldn't complain about that. These let her pass without incident, save a bow and a murmur of "Brightness radiant." She strode down the muraled hallway, the sphere lanterns set along the base of the walls making it pleasingly bright. Once she'd passed the empty library rooms to either side, she heard voices drifting toward her from ahead. She stepped up into the room where she'd faced the Midnight Mother, and got her first good look at the place when it wasn't covered in writhing darkness. The crystal pillar at the center really was something incredible. It wasn't a single gemstone, but a myriad of them fused together. Emerald, ruby, topaz, sapphire. All 10 varieties seemed to have been melted into a single thick pillar, 20 feet tall. Storms! What would it look like if all those gems were somehow infused, rather than done as they were at the moment? A large group of guards stood at a barricade near the other side of the room, looking down into the tunnel where the unmade had vanished. Yasna rounded the giant pillar, free hand resting on the crystal. The princess wore red, lips painted to match, hair up and run through with sword-like hair spikes, with rubies on the pommels. Storms! She was perfect. A curvaceous figure, tan alethi skin, light violet eyes, and not a hint of aberrant color to her jet-black hair. Making Yasna Kolin as beautiful as she was brilliant was one of the most unfair things the Almighty had ever done. Shallan hesitated in the doorway, feeling much as she had upon seeing Yasna for the first time in Carbranth. Insecure, overwhelmed, and, if she was honest, incredibly envious. Whatever ordeals Yasna had been through, she looked no worse for wear. That was remarkable, considering that the last time Shallan had seen Yasna, the woman had been lying unconscious on the floor while a man rammed a knife through her chest. "My mother," Yasna said, hand still on the pillar, not looking toward Shallan, "thinks this must be some kind of incredibly intricate fabrial. A logical assumption. We've always believed that the ancients had access to great and wonderful technology. How else do you explain shard blades and shard plate?" "Brightness?" Shallan said. "But shard blades aren't fabrials. They're spren, transformed by the bond. As are fabrials, after a manner of speaking," Yasna said. "You do know how they're made, don't you?" "Only vaguely," Shallan said. "This was how their reunion went? A lecture?" "Fitting." "You capture a spren," Yasna said, "and imprison it inside a gemstone crafted for the purpose. Artifabrians have found that specific stimuli will provoke certain responses in the spren. For example, flame spren give off heat. and by pressing metal against a ruby with a flame spren trapped inside, you can increase or decrease that heat.
That's incredible. Horrible, Shallan said.
She'd known some of this, but to contemplate it directly appalled her.
Brightness? We're imprisoning spren?
No worse than hitching a wagon to a chull.
Sure, if in order to get a chull to pull a wagon you first had to lock it in a box forever.
Pattern hummed softly from her skirts in agreement.
Yasna just cocked an eyebrow.
There are spren and there are spren, child. She rested her fingers on the pillar again.
Do a sketch of this for me. Be certain to get the proportions and colors right, if you please.
The careless presumption of the command hit Shallan like a slap in the face. What was she? Some servant? To be given orders?
Yes, a part of her affirmed. That's exactly what you are. You're Yasna's ward.
The request wasn't at all unusual in that light. But compared to how she had grown accustomed to being treated, it was...
Well, it wasn't worth taking offense at, and she should accept that.
Storms! When had she grown so touchy? She took out her sketch pad and got to work.
I was heartened to hear that you had made it here on your own, Yasna said. I apologize for what happened on Wind's Pleasure. My lack of foresight caused the deaths of many and doubtless hardship for you, Shallan. Please accept my regret.
Shallan shrugged, sketching.
You've done very well, Yasna continued. Imagine my amazement when I reached the Shattered Plains, only to discover that the war camp had already relocated to this tower. What you have accomplished is brilliant, child. We will need to speak further, however, about the group that again tried to assassinate me. The Ghost Bloods will almost certainly start targeting you, now that you've begun progressing toward your final ideals.
You're sure it was the Ghost Bloods that attacked the ship?
Of course I am.
She glanced at Shallan, lips turning down.
Are you certain you're well enough to be about, child? You seem uncharacteristically reserved.
I'm fine.
You're displeased because of the secrets I kept.
We all need secrets, Brightness. I know this more than anyone. But it would have been nice if you had let us know you were alive.
Here I was assuming I could handle things on my own. Assuming I'd have to handle things on my own. But all that time, you were on your way back to toss everything into the air again.
I only had the opportunity upon reaching the war camps, Yasna said. And there decided that I couldn't risk it. I was tired and unprotected. If the Ghost Bloods wished to finish me off, they could have done so at their leisure. I determined that a few more days of everyone believing I was dead would not greatly increase their distress.
But how did you even survive in the first place?
Child, I'm an Else Caller.
Of course. An Else Caller, Brightness. A thing you never explained. A word which no one but the most dedicated scholar of the esoteric would recognize. That explains it perfectly.
Yasna smiled for some reason.
All Radiants have an attachment to Shadesmar, Yasna said. Our spren originate there and our bond ties us to them. But my order has special control over moving between realms. I was able to shift to Shadesmar to escape my would-be assassins.
And that helped? With the knife in your storming chest?
No, Yasna said.
But surely by now you've learned the value of a little stormlight when it comes to bodily wounds.
Of course she had, and she could probably have guessed all of this. But for some reason she didn't want to accept that. She wanted to remain annoyed at Yasna.
My true difficulty was not escaping, but returning, Yasna said. My powers make it easy to transfer to Shadesmar, but getting back to this realm is no small feat. I had to find a transfer point, a place where Shadesmar and our realm touch, which is far, far more difficult than one might assume. It's like going downhill one way, but uphill to get back.
Well,
Perhaps her return would take some pressure off Shallan. Yasna could be brightness radiant, and Shallan could be, well, whatever she was. "We will need to converse further," Yasna said. "I would hear the exact story from your perspective of the discovery of Urethiru, and I assume you have sketches of the transformed Parshman? That will tell us much. I believe I once disparaged the usefulness of your artistic skill. I now find reason to call myself foolish for that presumption." "It's fine, Brightness," Shallan said with a sigh, still sketching the pillar. "I can get you those things, and there is a lot to talk about." But how much of it would she be able to say? How would Yasna react, for instance, to finding that Shallan had been dealing with the Ghost Bloods? "It's not like you're really a part of their organization," Shallan thought to herself. "If anything, you're using them for information. Yasna might find that admirable." Shallan still wasn't eager to broach the topic. "I feel lost," Yasna said. Shallan looked up from her sketchbook to find the woman regarding the pillar again, speaking softly, as if to herself. "For years I was at the very forefront of all this," Yasna said. "One short stumble and I find myself scrambling to stay afloat. These visions that my uncle is having, the refounding of the Radiance in my absence. That Wind Runner. What do you think of him, Shallan? I find him much as I imagined his order, but I have only met him once. It has all come so quickly. After years of struggling in the shadows, everything coming to light, and despite my years of study, I understand so very little." Shallan continued her sketch. "It was nice to be reminded that for all their differences, there were occasional things that she and Yasna shared. She just wished that ignorance weren't at the top of the list."
34. Resistance. "I noticed its arrival immediately, just as I noticed your many intrusions into my land."
"It is time," the Stormfather said.
All went dark around Dalinar, and he entered a place between his world and the visions, a place with a black sky and an infinite floor of bone-white rock. Shapes made of smoke seeped through the stone ground, then rose around him, dissipating. Common things, a chair, a vase, a rock bud. Sometimes people.
"I have her."
The Stonefather's voice shook this place, eternal and vast.
"The Thalen Queen. My storm hits her city now."
"Good," Dalinar said. "Please give her the vision." Finn was to see the vision with the Knights Radiant falling from the sky, come to deliver a small village from a strange and monstrous force. Dalinar wanted her to see the Knights Radiant firsthand, as they had once been, righteous, protecting.
"Where shall I put her?" the Stormfather asked.
"The same place you put me my first time," Dalinar said. "In the home, with the family."
"And you?"
"I'll observe, then talk to her after."
"You must be part of events," the Stormfather said, sounding stubborn. "You must take the role of someone. This is how it works."
"Fine. Pick someone. But if possible, make Fen see me as myself, and let me see her." He felt at the side sword he wore at his belt. "And can you let me keep this? I'd rather not have to fight with a poker again." The Stormfather rumbled in annoyance, but did not object. The place of endless white stone faded.
"What was that place?" Dalinar asked. "It is no place."
"But everything else in these visions is real," Dalinar said. "So why is it that—"
"It is no place," the Stormfather insisted firmly.
Dalinar fell silent, letting himself be taken by the vision.
I imagined it, the Stormfather said more softly, as if he were admitting something embarrassing. All things have a soul. A vase, a wall, a chair. And when a vase is broken, it might die in the physical realm, but for a time its soul remembers what it was. So all things die twice. Its final death is when men forget it was a vase, and think only of the pieces. I imagine the vase floating away then, its form dissolving into the nothingness.
Dalinar had never heard anything so philosophical from the Stormfather. He hadn't imagined it was possible that a Spren, even a mighty one of the High Storms, could dream in such a way. Dalinar found himself hurtling through the air. Flailing his arms, he shouted in panic. First Moon's violet light bathed the ground far below. His stomach lurched, and his clothes flapped in the wind. He continued yelling until he realized that he wasn't actually getting closer to the ground. He wasn't falling. He was flying. The air was rushing against the top of his head, not his face. Indeed, now he saw that his body was glowing, stormlight streaming off him. He didn't feel like he was holding it, though. No raging inside his veins, no urge to action. He shielded his face from the wind and looked forward. A radiant flew ahead, resplendent in blue armor that glowed, the light brightest at the edges and in the grooves. The man was looking back at Dalinar, doubtless because of his cries. Dalinar saluted him to indicate he was all right. The armored man nodded, looking forward again.
He's a windrunner, Dalinar thought, piecing it together. I've taken the place of his companion, a female radiant.
He'd seen these two in the vision before. They were flying to save the village. Dalinar wasn't moving under his own power. The Windrunner had lashed the female radiant into the sky, as Zeth had done to Dalinar during the Battle of Narak. It was still difficult to accept that he wasn't falling, and a sinking feeling persisted in the pit of his stomach. He tried to focus on other things. He was wearing an unfamiliar brown uniform, though he was glad to note that he had his side sword as requested. But why didn't he have on shard plate? In the vision, the woman had worn a set that glowed amber. Was this the result of the Stormfather trying to make him look like himself to Fenn? Dalinar still didn't know why radiant plate glowed, while modern shard plate did not. Was the ancient plate living somehow, like radiant blades lived? Perhaps he could find out from that radiant ahead. He had to ask his questions carefully, however. Everyone would see Dalinar as the radiant he had replaced, and if his questions were uncharacteristic, that tended only to confuse people, rather than get him answers.
How far away are we? Dalinar asked.
The sound was lost in the wind, so he shouted it more loudly, drawing the attention of his companion.
Not long now,
the man shouted back, voice echoing inside his helm, which glowed blue, most strongly at the edges and across the eye slit.
I think something might be wrong with my armor, Dalinar shouted to him. I can't make my helm retract.
In response, the other radiant made his vanish. Dalinar caught sight of a puff of light or mist. Beneath the helm, the man had dark skin and curly black hair. His eyes glowed blue.
Retract your helm? He shouted. You haven't summoned your armor yet. You had to dismiss it so I could lash you.
Oh, Dalinar thought.
I mean earlier. It wouldn't vanish when I wanted it to. Talk to Har-Kalane, then. Or to your Spren.
The Windrunner frowned.
Will this be a problem for our mission?
I don't know,
Dalinar shouted.
But it distracted me. Tell me again how we know where to go, and what we know of the things we're going to fight.
He winced at how awkward that sounded.
Just be ready to back me up against the Midnight Essence and use regrowth on any wounded.
But
you will find difficulty getting useful answers, Son of Honor, the Stormfather rumbled. These do not have souls or minds. They are recreations forged by Honor's will, and do not have the memories of the real people. Surely we can learn things, Dalinar said under his breath. They were created to convey only certain ideas. Further pressing will merely reveal the thinness of the facade.
This brought up memories of the fake city Dalinar had visited in his first vision, the destroyed version of Kolinar that was more prop than reality. But there had to be things he could learn, things that Honor might not have intended but had included by chance.
I need to get Navani and Yasna in here, he thought. Let them pick at these recreations.
Last time in this vision, Dalinar had taken the place of a man named Heb, a husband and father who had defended his family with only a fireplace poker for a weapon. He remembered his frantic struggle with a beast of oily midnight skin. He had fought, bled, agonized. He'd spent what seemed like an eternity trying and eventually failing to protect his wife and daughter. Such a personal memory. False though it was, he had lived it. In fact, seeing the small town ahead, in the light created by a large ridge of rock, made emotions well up inside Dalinar. It was a painful irony that he should have such vivid feelings about this place, these people, when his memories of Evie were still so shadowy and confused. The Windrunner slowed Dalinar by grabbing his arm. They drew to a stop in midair, hovering above the rocky flats outside the village.
There!
The Windrunner pointed to the field around the town, where weird black creatures were swarming. About the size of an axe-hound, they had oily skin that reflected the moonlight. While they moved on all sixes, they were like no natural animal. They had spindly legs like a crab's, but a bulbous body and a sinuous head, featureless except for a slit of a mouth bristling with black teeth. Shallan had faced the source of these things deep within Urethiru. Dalinar had slept a little less secure each night since, knowing that one of the unmade had been hidden in the bowels of the tower. Were the other eight similarly lurking nearby?
I'll go down first, the Windrunner said, and draw their attention. You make for the town and help the people there.
The man pressed his hand against Dalinar.
You'll drop in about 30 seconds.
The man's helm materialized, then he plunged toward the monsters. Dalinar remembered that descent from the vision, like a falling star come to rescue Dalinar and the family.
How? Dalinar whispered to the Stormfather. How do we get the armor? Speak the words.
Which words?
You will know or you will not.
Great. Dalinar saw no sign of Taffa or Seeley, the family he'd protected, below. In his version, they'd been out here, but their flight had been his doing. He couldn't be sure how the vision had played out this time. Storms. He hadn't planned this very well, had he? In his mind's eye, he'd anticipated getting to Queen Fen and helping her along, making sure she wasn't in too much danger. Instead, he'd wasted time flying here. Stupid. He needed to learn to be more specific with the Stormfather. Dalinar began to descend in a controlled float. He had some idea of how the Windrunner surges worked together, but he was impressed nonetheless. Just as he touched down, the feeling of lightness left him and the stormlight rising from his skin puffed away. This left him as much less of a target in the darkness than the other Radiant, who glowed like a brilliant blue beacon, sweeping about himself with a grand shard blade as he fought the Midnight Essence. Dalinar crept through the town, his common side sword feeling frail compared to a shard blade, but at least it wasn't an iron poker. Some of the creatures scrambled by on the main thoroughfare, but Dalinar hid beside a boulder until they passed. He easily identified the proper house, which had a small barn out back, nestled against the stone cliff that sheltered the town. He crept up and found that the barn wall had been ripped open. He remembered hiding in there with Seeley, then fleeing as a monster attacked. The barn was empty, so he headed for the house, which was much finer. Made of creme bricks and larger, though it seemed only one family lived in it. For a house this big, That would be an oddity, wouldn't it? Space was at a premium in Lates. Some of his assumptions obviously didn't hold in this era. In Alethkar, a fine wooden mansion would be a symbol of wealth. Here, however, many of the other houses were of wood. Dalinar slipped into the house, feeling increasingly worried. Fenn's real body couldn't be harmed by what happened in the vision, but she could still feel pain. So while the injuries might not be real, her anger at Dalinar certainly would be. He could ruin any chance of her listening to him. "She's already given up on listening," he assured himself. Navani agreed. This vision couldn't make things worse. He felt in his uniform's pocket and was pleased to find some gemstones. A radiant would have stormlight. He took out a small diamond, the size of a pebble, and used its white light to inspect the room. The table had been overturned, chairs scattered. The door hung open and creaked softly in a breeze. There was no sign of Queen Fenn, but Taffa's body lay face down near the hearth. She wore a single-piece brown dress, now in tatters. Dalinar sighed, sheathing his sword and kneeling to gently touch her back in a spot unraked by monster claws. "It's not real," he told himself. "Not now. This woman lived and died thousands of years ago." It still hurt to see her. He walked to the swinging door and stepped outside into the night, where howls and cries rang out from the town. He strode quickly down the roadway, feeling a sense of urgency. No, not just urgency, impatience. Seeing Taffa's corpse had changed something. He was not a confused man trapped in a nightmare as he'd feared when first visiting this place. Why was he sneaking? These visions belonged to him. He should not fear their contents. One of the creatures scuttled out of the shadows. Dalinar drew in stormlight as it leaped and bit at his leg. Pain flared up his side, but he ignored it, and the wound re-knit. He glanced down as the creature lunged again, with similar lack of results. It scurried backward a few paces, and he could sense confusion in its posture. This was not how its prey was supposed to act. "You don't eat the corpses," Dalinar said to it. "You kill for pleasure, don't you? I often think of how Spren and man are so different, but this we share. We can both murder." The unholy thing came at him again, and Dalinar seized it in both hands. The body felt springy to the touch, like a wineskin filled to bursting. He painted the writhing monster with stormlight and spun, hurling it toward a nearby building. The creature hit the wall back first and stuck there several feet above the ground, legs scrambling. Dalinar continued on his way. He simply cut through the next two creatures that came for him. Their disjointed bodies twitched, black smoke leaking from the carcasses. "What is that light?" It danced in the night ahead, growing stronger, harsh, orange, flooding the end of the street. He didn't remember a fire from before. Were homes burning? Dalinar approached and found a bonfire, flickering with flame spren, built of furniture. It was surrounded by dozens of people holding brooms and crude picks, men and women alike, armed with whatever they could find, even an iron poker or two. Judging by the fear spren gathered around them, the townspeople were terrified. They managed some semblance of ranks anyway, with children at the center, nearer the fires, as they frantically defended themselves from the midnight monsters. A figure near the fire commanded from the top of a box. Fenn's voice had no accent. To Dalinar, her shouts seemed to be in perfect Alethi, though, in the strange way of these visions, everyone present was actually speaking and thinking in an ancient language. "How did she manage this so quickly?" Dalinar wondered, mesmerized by the fighting townsfolk. Some of them fell in bloody screaming heaps, but others pinned down the monsters and stabbed open their backs, sometimes with kitchen knives, to deflate them. Dalinar remained on the outskirts of the battle until a dramatic figure in glowing blue swept down upon the scene. The Windrunner made short work of the remaining creatures. At the end, he saved a glare for Dalinar.
"What are you doing standing there? Why haven't you helped?"
I... We'll have words about this when we return, he shouted, pointing toward one of the fallen. Go! Help the wounded!
Dalinar followed the gesture, but walked toward Fenn instead of the wounded. Some of the townspeople huddled and wept, though others exulted in survival, cheering and holding up their improvised weapons. He'd seen these after-effects of a battle before. The welling up of emotions came in a variety of ways. The bonfire's heat caused Dalinar's brow to sweat. Smoke churned in the air, reminding him of the place he'd been before he'd fully entered this vision. He'd always loved the warmth of an actual fire, dancing with flame spren, so eager to burn themselves out and die. Ben was over a foot shorter than Dalinar, with an oval face, yellow eyes, and white Thalen eyebrows she kept curled to hang down beside her cheeks. She did not braid her gray hair like an Alethi woman would have, but instead let it fall down to cover her shoulders. The vision had given her a simple shirt and trousers to wear, the costume of the man she'd replaced, though she'd found a glove for her safe hand. "Now the Blackthorn himself shows up," she said. "Damnation, this is a strange dream." "Not quite a dream, Fenn," Dalinar said, looking back toward the Radiant, who had charged a small group of midnight monsters coming down the street. "I don't know if I have time to explain."
"I can slow it down," one of the villagers said in the Stormfather's voice. "Yes, please," Dalinar said.
Everything stopped, or slowed greatly. The bonfire's flames shimmered lethargically, and the people slowed to a crawl. Dalinar was unaffected, as was Fenn. He sat down in a box beside the one Fenn stood on, and she hesitantly settled down next to him.
"A very strange dream. I assumed I was dreaming myself when I saw the first vision," Dalinar said. "When they kept happening, I was forced to acknowledge that no dream is this crisp, this logical. In no dream could we be having this conversation."
"In every dream I've experienced, what happened felt natural at the time."
"Then you will know the difference when you wake. I can show many more of these visions to you, Fenn. They were left for us by a being with some interest in helping us survive the desolations."
Best not to get into his heresy at the moment.
"If one isn't persuasive enough, I understand. I'm dense enough that I didn't trust them for months."
"Are they all this, invigorating?"
Dalinar smiled.
"This was the most powerful of them, to me."
He looked to her.
"You did better than I did. I worried only about Taffa and her daughter, but just ended up getting them surrounded by monsters anyway."
"I let the woman die," Fenn said softly. "I ran with the child and let the thing kill her. Used her almost as bait."
She looked at Dalinar, eyes haunted.
"What was your purpose in this, Colin? You imply you have power over these visions. Why did you trap me in this one?"
"Honestly, I just wanted to talk to you."
"Send me a storming letter."
"In person, Fenn."
He nodded toward the gathered townspeople.
"You did this. You organized the town, pitted them against the enemy. It's remarkable. You expect me to accept that you will turn your back on the world in a similar moment of need?"
"Don't be dense. My kingdom is suffering. I'm seeing to my people's needs. I'm not turning my back on anyone."
Dalinar looked to her and pursed his lips, but said nothing.
"Fine," she snapped. "Fine, Colin. You want to dig into it for real? Tell me this. You really expect me to believe that the Storming Knights Radiant are back, and that the Almighty chose you, a tyrant and a murderer, to lead them?"
In response, Dalinar stood up and drew in stormlight. His skin began glowing with luminescent smoke drifting from his body.
"If you wish proof, I can persuade you. Incredible though it seems, the Radiants have returned."
"And the second part? Yes, there is a new storm and perhaps new manifestations of power. Fine. What I don't accept is that you, Dalinar Kholin, have been told by the Almighty to lead us.
I have been commanded to unite.
A mandate from God. The very same argument the Hierocracy used for seizing control of the government. What about Sadies, the Sunmaker? He claimed he had a calling from the Almighty, too.
She stood and walked among the people of the town, who stood as if frozen, barely moving. She turned and swept a hand back toward Dalinar.
Now here you are, saying the same things in the same way, not quite threats, but insistent. Let us join forces. If we don't, the world is doomed.
Dalinar felt his patience slipping. He clenched his jaw, forced himself to be calm, and rose.
Your Majesty, you're being irrational.
Am I? Oh, let me storming reconsider, then. All I need to do is let the storming Blackthorn himself into my city, so he can take control of my armies.
What would you have me do?
Dalinar shouted.
Would you have me watch the world crumble?
She cocked her head at his outburst.
Maybe you're right, and I am a tyrant. Maybe letting my armies into your city is a terrible risk. But maybe you don't have good options. Maybe all the good men are dead, so all you have is me. Spitting into the storm isn't going to change that, Fen. You can risk possibly being conquered by the Alethi, or you can definitely fall to the Voidbringer assault alone.
Curiously, Fen crossed her arms and raised her left hand to her chin, inspecting Dalinar. She didn't seem the least bit fazed by his shouting. Dalinar stepped past a squat man who was slowly, as if through tar, turning toward where they'd once been seated.
Fen, Dalinar said, you don't like me. Fine. You tell me to my face that trusting me is worse than a desolation.
She studied him, aged eyes thoughtful. What was wrong? What had he said?
Fen, he tried again, I...
Where was this passion earlier? She asked. Why didn't you speak like this in your letters to me?
I... Fen, I was being diplomatic.
She sniffed.
That made it sound like I was talking to a committee. It's what one always assumes anyway when communicating via Spanread.
So?
So compared to that, it's good to hear some honest shouting.
She eyed the people standing around them.
And this is exceptionally creepy. Can we get away from this?
Dalinar found himself nodding, mostly to buy some time to think. Fen seemed to think his anger was a good thing. He gestured at a path through the crowd, and Fen joined him, walking away from the bonfire.
Fen, he said, you say you expected to talk to a committee through the Spanread. What's wrong with that? Why would you want me to shout at you instead?
I don't want you to shout at me, Kholin, she said. But storms, man. Don't you know what has been said about you these last few months?
No.
You've been the hottest topic on the Spanread informant networks. Dalinar Kholin, the Blackthorn, has gone mad. He claims to have killed the Almighty. One day he refuses to fight, then the next day he marches his armies off on an insane quest into the Shattered Plains. He says he's going to enslave the Voidbringers.
I didn't say...
Nobody expects every report to be true, Dalinar. But I had extremely good information claiming you'd lost your mind. Refounding the Knights Radiant? Raving about a desolation? You seized the throne of Alethkar in all but title, but refused to fight the other high princes, and instead ran your armies off into the Weeping. Then you told everyone a new storm was coming. That was enough to convince me that you really were mad.
But then the storm came, Dalinar said.
But then the storm came.
The two walked down the quiet street, light from behind flooding across them, making their shadows lengthen. To their right, a calm blue light shone between buildings, the Radiant, who fought monsters in slowed time. Yasna could probably learn something from these buildings with their old architecture. These people wearing unfamiliar clothing. He'd have expected everything in the past to be crude, but it wasn't. The doors, the buildings, the clothing. It was well made, just lacking something he couldn't define.
"The Everstorm proved I wasn't mad?" Dalinar asked.
"It proved that something was happening." Dalinar suddenly stopped.
"You think I'm working with them? You think that explains my behavior, my foreknowledge? You think I've been acting erratically because I've been in contact with the Voidbringers?"
"All I knew," Fenn said, "was that the voice on the other end of the span reed was not the Dalinar Kolin I'd expected. The words were too polite, too calm, to be trusted."
"And now?" Dalinar asked.
Fenn turned. "Now, I'll consider. Can I see the rest of it? I want to know what happens to the little girl."
Dalinar followed her gaze and saw, for the first time, little Seely sitting, huddled with some other children near the fire. She had a haunted cast to her eyes. He could imagine her horror as Fenn ran away, Taffa, the child's mother, screaming as she was ripped apart. Seely suddenly lurched into motion, turning her head to stare with a hollow gaze at a woman who knelt beside her, offering something to drink. The Stormfather had restored the vision's normal speed. Dalinar backed up, letting Fenn rejoin the people and experience the end of the vision. As he folded his arms to watch, he noted a shimmering in the air beside him.
"We'll want to send her more of these," Dalinar said to the Stormfather. "We can only be served by more people knowing the truths the Almighty left behind. Can you bring in only one person per storm, or can we accelerate that somehow? And can you bring two people into two different visions at once?"
The Stormfather rumbled.
"I do not like to be ordered about."
"And you prefer the alternative? Letting Odium win? How far will your pride push you, Stormfather?"
"It is not pride," the Stormfather said, sounding stubborn. "I am not a man. I do not bend or cower. I do what is in my nature, and to defy that is pain."
The Radiant finished off the last of the midnight creatures and stepped up to the gathered people, then looked at Fenn.
"Your upbringing might be humble, but your talent for leadership is impressive. I have rarely seen a man, king or commander, organize people for defense as well as you did here today."
Fenn cocked her head.
"No words for me, I see," the knight said. "Very well. But should you wish to learn true leadership, come to Urethiru."
Dalinar turned to the Stormfather.
"That's almost exactly what the knight said to me last time."
"By design, certain things always happen in the visions," the Stormfather replied. "I do not know Honor's every intention, but I know he wished you to interact with Radiance and know that men could join them."
"All who resist are needed," the Radiant said to Fenn. "Indeed, any who have a desire to fight should be compelled to come to Alethala. We can teach you, help you. If you have the soul of a warrior, that passion could destroy you unless you are guided. Come to us."
The Radiant strode off, then Fenn jumped as Seely stood up and started talking to her. The girl's voice was too quiet for Dalinar to hear, but he could guess what was happening. At the end of each vision, the Almighty himself spoke through one of the people, passing along wisdom that, at first, Dalinar had assumed was interactive. Fenn seemed troubled by what she heard. As well she should be. Dalinar remembered the words. "This is important," the Almighty had said. "Do not let strife consume you. Be strong. Act with honor, and honor will aid you." Except honor was dead. At the end of it, Fen turned toward Dalinar, her eyes measuring.
"She still does not trust you," the Stormfather said.
"She wonders if I created this vision with the power of the Voidbringers. She no longer thinks I'm mad, but she does continue to wonder if I've joined the enemy."
"So you've failed again."
"No," Dalinar said.
"Tonight she listened, and I think she'll end up taking the gamble of coming to Yuathiru."
The Stormfather rumbled, sounding confused.
"Why?"
"Because," Dalinar said, "I know how to talk to her now. She doesn't want polite words or diplomatic phrases. She wants me to be myself. I'm fairly certain that's something I can deliver."
35. First into the sky. "You think yourself so clever, but my eyes are not those of some petty noble to be clouded by a false nose and some dirt on the cheeks." Someone bumped Sigzil's cot, waking him from a dream. He yawned, and Rock's breakfast bell began ringing in the next room. He'd been dreaming in Azish. He'd been back home studying for the governmental service tests. Passing would have qualified him to enter a real school with a shot at becoming a clerk to someone important. Only in the dream, he'd been panicked to realize he'd forgotten how to read. After so many years away, thinking of his mother tongue felt strange. He yawned again, settling on his cot, back to the stone wall. They had three small barracks and a common room in the center. Out there, everyone pushed, ramble-scramble, up to the breakfast table. Rock had to shout at them, yet again, to organize themselves. Months in Bridge Four, now apprentice Knights Radiant, and a lot of them still couldn't figure out how to line up properly. They wouldn't last a day in Azir, where queuing in an orderly way wasn't only expected, it was practically a mark of national pride. Sigzil rested his head against the wall, remembering. He'd been the first from his family in generations with a real shot at passing the exams. A silly dream. Everyone in Azir talked about how even the humblest man could become prime, but the son of a laborer had so little time to study. He shook his head, then washed with a basin of water he'd fetched the night before. He took a comb to his hair and inspected himself in a polished length of steel. His hair was growing far too long. The tight black curls had a tendency to stick straight out. He set out a sphere to use its light for a shave. He had acquired his own razor. Soon after he started, however, he nicked himself. He sucked in a breath at the pain, and his sphere winked out. What? His skin started glowing, letting off a faint, luminescent smoke. Oh, right. Kaladin was back. Well, that was going to solve so many problems. He got out another sphere and did his best not to eat this one as he finished shaving. Afterward, he pressed his hand against his forehead. Once, he'd had slave brands there. The stormlight had healed those, though his Bridge Four tattoo remained. He rose and put on his uniform. Colin blue, sharp and neat. He slid his new hogshide notebook into his pocket, then stepped out into the common room, and stopped short as Lopin's face swung down right in front of him. Sigzil almost slammed into the Herdazian, who was stuck by the bottoms of his feet to the storming ceiling. "Hey!" Lopin said, bowl of morning porridge held upside down, or, well, right side up, but upside down to Lopin, in front of him. The Herdazian tried to take a bite, but the porridge slipped off his spoon and splatted to the ground.
"Lopin, what are you doing?"
"Practicing. I've got to show them how good I am, Hooch. It's like with women. Only it involves sticking yourself to the ceiling and learning not to spill food on the heads of people you like."
"Move, Lopin."
"Ah, you have to ask the right way. I'm not one-armed anymore. I can't be shoved around. Say, do you know how to get two-armed Herdazians to do what you want?"
"If I did, we wouldn't be having this conversation."
"Well, You take away both of their spears, obviously. He grinned.
A few feet away, Rock laughed with a loud,
Huh!
Lopin wiggled his fingers at Sigzil, as if to taunt him, fingernails glistening. Like all Herdazians, he had fingernails that were dark brown and hard as crystal, a bit reminiscent of carapace. He still had a tattoo on his head, too. Though so far only a few of Bridge Four had learned to draw in Stormlight, each of those had kept their tattoos. Only Kaladin was different. His tattoo had melted off once he took in Stormlight, and his scars refused to heal.
"Remember that one for me, Hooch?" Lopin said.
He never would explain what Hooch meant, or why he used it only to refer to Sigzil.
"I'll need sure lots and lots of new jokes. Also sleeves. Twice as many of those, except on vests. Then the same number."
"How did you even manage to get up there? So you could stick your feet?"
No. Don't start. I don't actually want to know."
Sigzil ducked under Lopin. The men were still scrambling for food, laughing and shouting in complete disarray. Sigzil shouted to get their attention.
"Don't forget! The captain wanted us up and ready for inspection by second bell!"
Sigzil could barely be heard. Where was Teft? They actually listened when he gave orders. Sigzil shook his head, weaving his way toward the door. Among his people, he was of average height. But he'd gone and moved among the Alethi, who were practically giants. So here, he was a few inches shorter than most. He slipped out into the hallway. The bridge crews occupied a sequence of large barracks on the tower's first floor. Bridge Four were gaining radiant powers, but there were hundreds more men in the battalion who were still ordinary infantry. Perhaps Teft had gone to inspect the other crews. He'd been given responsibility for training them. Hopefully it wasn't the other thing. Kaladin bunked in his own small suite of rooms at the end of the hallway. Sigzil made his way there, going over his scribbles in the notebook. He used Alethi glyphs, as was acceptable for a man out here, and had never learned their actual writing system. Storms, he'd been away so long, the dream was probably right. He might have trouble writing in the Azish script. What would life be like if he hadn't turned into a failure and a disappointment? If he'd passed the tests instead of getting into trouble, needing to be rescued by the man who had become his master? The list of problems first, he decided, reaching Kaladin's door and knocking.
Come,
the captain's voice said from inside. Sigzil found Kaladin doing morning push-ups on the stone floor. His blue jacket was draped over a chair.
Sir,
Sigzil said.
Hey, Sig,
Kaladin said, grunting as he continued his push-ups.
Are the men up and mustered?
Up, yes, Sigzil said. When I left them, they seemed bordering on a food fight, and only half were in uniform.
They'll be ready, Kaladin said. Was there something you wanted, Sig?
Sigzil settled down in the chair next to Kaladin's coat and opened his notebook.
A lot of things, sir. Not the least of which is the fact that you should have a real scribe, not whatever I am.
You're my clerk.
A poor one. We have a full battalion of fighting men with only 3 lieutenants and no official scribes. Frankly, sir, the bridge crews are a mess. Our finances are in shambles, requisition orders are piling up faster than Leighton can deal with them, and there's an entire host of problems requiring an officer's attention.
Kaladin grunted.
The fun part of running an army.
Exactly.
That was sarcasm, Sig. Kaladin stood up and wiped his brow with a towel.
All right, go ahead.
We'll start with something easy, Sigzil said. Pete is now officially betrothed to the woman he's been seeing.
Ka? That's wonderful.
Maybe she could help you with scribe duties.
Perhaps.
I believe that you were looking into requisitioning housing for men with families?
Yeah, that was before the whole mess with the Weeping and the expedition under the Shattered Plains, and I should go back to Dalinar's scribes about it, shouldn't I?
Unless you expect the married couples to share a bunk in the standard barracks, then I'd say that yes, you should.
Sigzil looked to the next page in his book.
I believe Bissig is close to being betrothed as well.
Really? He's so quiet.
I never know what's going on behind those eyes of his. Not to mention Punio, who I found out recently is already married. His wife drops off food for him. I thought that was his sister. He wanted to fit in, I believe, Sigsel said. His broken Alethi already makes that hard. And then there's the matter of Drahi.
What matter?
Well, he's been courting a man, you see.
Kaladin threw on his coat, chuckling.
I did know about that one. You only now noticed?
Sigsel nodded.
It's Drew he's been seeing still, from the district quartermaster's offices?
Yes, sir. Sigsel looked down.
Sir, I... Well, it's just that...
Yes?
Sir, Drahi hasn't filled out the proper forms, Sigsel said. If he wants to court another man, he needs to apply for social reassignment, right?
Kaladin rolled his eyes. So, there were no forms for that in Alethkar. Sigsel couldn't say he was surprised, as the Alethi didn't have proper procedures for anything.
Then how do you apply for social reassignment?
We don't, Kaladin frowned.
Is this really that big a problem to you, Sig? Maybe, sir, it's not this specifically. Right now there are four religions represented in Bridge Four.
Four?
Hubber follows the passions, sir. Four, even if you don't count Teft, who I can't figure out rightly. And now there's all this talk of Bright Lord Dalinar claiming the Almighty is dead, and... Well, I feel responsible, sir.
For Dalinar? Kaladin frowned.
No, no.
He took a deep breath. There had to be a way to explain this. What would his master do?
And now,
Sigsel said, scrambling at an idea.
Everybody knows that Mishim, the third moon, is the most clever and wily of the moons.
All right. And this is relevant. Why?
Because of a story, Sigsel said. Hush! Please listen, sir. You see, there are three moons, and the third moon is the cleverest. And she doesn't want to be in the sky, sir. She wants to escape. So one night, she tricked the queen of the Natan people. This was a long time ago, so they were still around. I mean, they're still around now, but they were more around then, sir. And the moon tricked her. And then they traded places until they stopped. And now the Natan people have blue skin. Does that make sense?
Kaladin blinked. I have no idea what you just said.
Sigsel said. It's obviously fanciful. Not the real reason that the Natan people have blue skin, and,
It was supposed to explain something?
It's how my master always did things, Sigsel said, looking at his feet. He'd tell a story any time someone was confused, or when people were angry at him. And, well, it changed everything, somehow.
He looked to Kaladin. I suppose, Kaladin said slowly, that maybe you feel like a moon?
No, not really.
It was about responsibility, but he had really not explained it well. Storms. Master Hoyt had named him a full world singer, and here he couldn't even tell a story straight. Kaladin clapped him on the shoulder.
It's all right, Sig. Sir, Sigsel said, the other men don't have any direction. You've given them purpose, a reason to be good men. They are good men. But in some ways it was easy when we were slaves. What do we do if not all the men manifest the ability to draw in Stormlight? What is our place in the army? Bright Lord Colin released us from guard duty, as he said he wanted us practicing and training as Radiants instead. But what is a Knight Radiant?
We'll need to figure it out.
And if the men need guidance? If they need a moral center? Someone has to talk to them when they're doing something wrong. But the Ardents ignore us, since they associate us with the things Bright Lord Dalinar is saying and doing.
You think you can be the one to guide the men instead? Kaladin asked.
Someone should, sir.
Kaladin waved for Sigsel to follow him out into the corridor. Together they started walking toward the Bridge Four barracks, Sigsel holding out a sphere for light.
I don't mind if you want to be something like our unit's Ardent, Kaladin said. The men like you, Sig,
and they put a lot of stock in what you have to say. But you should try to understand what they want out of life, and respect that, rather than projecting onto them what you think they should want out of life.
But, sir, some things are just wrong. You know what Teft has gotten into, and Huio. He's been visiting the prostitutes.
That's not forbidden. Storms, I've had some sergeants who suggested it as the key to a healthy mind in battle.
It's wrong, sir. It's imitating an oath without the commitment. Every major religion agrees to this except the Reshi, I suppose. But they're pagans even among pagans.
Your master teach you to be this judgmental? Sigzel stopped short.
I'm sorry, Sig, Kaladin said. No, he said the same thing about me. All the time, sir.
I give you permission to sit down with Huio and explain your worries, Kaladin said. I won't forbid you from expressing your morals. I'd encourage it. Just don't present your beliefs as our code. Present them as yours, and make a good argument. Maybe the men will listen.
Sigzel nodded, hurrying to catch up. To cover his embarrassment, more at completely failing to tell the right story than anything else, he dug into his notebook.
That does raise another issue, sir. Bridge 4 is down to 28 members after our losses during the first Everstorm. Might be time for some recruitment.
Recruitment? Kaladin said. He cocked his head.
Well, if we lose any more members, we won't,
Kaladin said. He always thought that.
Or, even if we don't, we're down from the 35 or 40 of a good bridge crew. Maybe we don't need to keep that number, but a good active unit should always be watching for people to recruit. What if someone else in the army has been displaying the right attitude to be a windrunner? Or, more pointedly, what if our men start swearing oaths and bonding their own spren? Would we dissolve Bridge 4 and let each man be their own Radiant?
The idea of dissolving Bridge 4 seemed to pain Kaladin almost as much as the idea of losing men in battle. They walked in silence for a short time. They weren't going to the Bridge 4 barracks after all. Kaladin had taken a turn deeper into the tower. They passed a water wagon, pulled by laborers to deliver water from the wells to the officers' quarters. Normally, that would be parshman work.
We should at least put out a call for recruitment, Kaladin finally said. Though honestly, I can't think of how I'll cull hopefuls down to a manageable number.
I'll try to come up with some strategies, sir, Sigzel said. If I might ask, where are we?
He trailed off as he saw Lynn hurrying down the hallway toward them. She carried a diamond chip in her palm for light and wore her Kolin uniform, her dark Alethi hair pulled back in a tail. She drew up when she saw Kaladin, then saluted him smartly.
Just the man I was looking for. Quartermaster Vevidar sends word that your unusual request has been fulfilled, sir.
Excellent, Kaladin said, marching through the hallway past her. Sigzel shot her a look as she fell in with him, and she shrugged. She didn't know what the unusual request was, only that it had been fulfilled. Kaladin eyed Lynn as they walked.
You're the one who has been helping my men, right?
Lynn, was it? Yes, sir.
In fact, it seems you've been making excuses to run messages to Bridge 4.
Yes, sir.
Not afraid of the lost Radiance, then?
Frankly, sir, after what I saw on the battlefield, I'd rather be on your side than bet on the opposition.
Kaladin nodded, thoughtful as he walked. Lynn, he finally said, how would you like to join the Windrunners? The woman stopped in place, jaw dropping.
Sir?
She saluted.
Sir, I'd love that. Storms! Excellent, Kaladin said.
Sig, can you get her our ledgers and accounts?
Lynn's hand drooped from her brow.
Ledgers? Accounts?
The men will also need letters written to family members, Kaladin said. And we should probably write a history of Bridge 4. People will be curious, and a written account will save me from having to explain it all the time.
Oh, Lynn said. A scribe.
Of course, Kaladin said, turning back toward her in the hallway, frowning. You're a woman, aren't you?
I thought you were asking... I mean, in the High Prince's visions, there were women who were Knights Radiant, and with Brightness Shallan, she blushed. Sir, I didn't join the Scouts because I liked sitting around staring at ledgers. If that's what you're offering, I'll have to pass.
Her shoulders fell, and she wouldn't meet Kaladin's eyes. Sigsel found, strangely, that he wanted to punch his captain. Not hard, mind you, just a gentle wake-up punch. He couldn't remember feeling that way with Kaladin since the time the captain had woken him up that first morning back in Sadius's war camp.
I see, Kaladin said. Well, we're going to have tryouts to join the Order proper. I suppose I could extend you an invitation, if you'd like.
Tryouts? She said. For real positions? Not just doing accounts?
Storms, I'm in.
Speak with your superior, then, Kaladin said. I haven't devised the proper test yet, and you'd need to pass it before you could be let in. Either way, you'd need clearance to change battalions.
Yes, sir, she said,
and bounded off. Kaladin watched her go, then grunted softly. Sigsel, without even thinking about it, mumbled, Did your master teach you to be that insensitive? Kaladin eyed him.
I have a suggestion, sir, Sigsel continued. Try to understand what people want out of life and respect that, rather than projecting onto them what you think they should...
Shut it, Sig.
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir.
They continued on their way, and Kaladin cleared his throat. You don't have to be so formal with me, you know.
I know, sir. But you're a Light Eyes now, and a Shardbearer, and... Well, it feels right.
Kaladin stiffened, but didn't contradict him. In truth, Sigsel had always felt awkward trying to treat Kaladin like any other bridgeman. Some of the others could do it, Tefton Rock, Lopin in his own strange way, but Sigsel felt more comfortable when the relationship was set out and clear, captain and his clerk. Moash had been the closest to Kaladin, but he wasn't in Bridge Four any longer. Kaladin hadn't said what Moash had done, only that he had removed himself from our fellowship. Kaladin got stiff and unresponsive whenever Moash's name was mentioned.
Anything else on that list of yours? Kaladin asked as they passed a guard patrol in the hallway.
He received crisp salutes. Sigsel looked through his notebook.
Accounts and the need for scribes, code of morals for the men, recruitment. Oh, we're still going to need to define our place in the army, now that we're no longer bodyguards.
We're still bodyguards, Kaladin said. We just protect anyone who needs it. We have bigger problems in that storm. It had come again, a third time, this event proving that it was even more regular than the high storms, right around every 9 days. Up high as they were, its passing was only a curiosity. But throughout the world, each new arrival strained already beleaguered cities.
I realize that, sir, Sigsel said, but we still have to worry about procedure. Here, let me ask this. Are we, as Knights Radiant, still an Alethi military organization?
No, Kaladin said. This war is bigger than Alethkar. We're for all mankind.
All right. Then what's our chain of command? Do we obey King Elokar? Are we still his subjects? And what Don or Non are we in society? You're a Shardbearer in Dalinar's court, aren't you? Who pays the wages of Bridge Four? What about the other bridge crews? If there is a squabble over Dalinar's lands in Alethkar, can he call you and Bridge Four up to fight for him, like a normal liege-vassal relationship? If not, then can we still expect him to pay us?
Damnation, Kaladin breathed.
I'm sorry, sir, it...
No, they're good questions, Sig. I'm lucky to have you to ask them. He clasped Sigsel on the shoulder, stopping in the hallway just outside the quartermaster's offices. Sometimes I wonder if you're wasted in Bridge Four. You should have been a scholar.
Well, that wind blew past me years ago, sir.
He took a deep breath.
I failed the exams for government training in Aesir. I wasn't good enough.
Then the exams were stupid, Kaladin said.
and Aesir lost out because they missed the chance to have you.
Sigsel smiled.
I'm glad they did.
And, strangely, he felt it was true. A nameless weight he'd been carrying seemed to slide off his back.
Honestly, I feel like Lin. I don't want to be huddled over a ledger when Bridge 4 takes to the air. I want to be first into the sky.
I think you'll have to fight Lopin for that distinction, Kaladin said with a chuckle. Come on. He strode into the quartermaster's office, where a group of waiting guardsmen immediately made space for him. At the counter, a beefy soldier with rolled-up sleeves searched through boxes and crates, muttering to himself. A stout woman, presumably his wife, inspected requisition forms. She nudged the man and pointed at Kaladin.
Finally, the quartermaster said. I'm tired of having these here, drawing everyone's eyes and making me sweat like a spy with too many spren.
He shuffled over to a pair of large black sacks in the corner that, best that Sigsel could tell, weren't drawing any eyes at all. The quartermaster hefted them and glanced at the scribe, who double-checked a few forms, then nodded, presenting them for Kaladin to stamp with his captain's seal. Paperwork done, the quartermaster handed a sack to Kaladin and another to Sigsel. They clinked when moved and were surprisingly heavy. Sigsel undid the ties and glanced into his. A flood of green light, powerful as sunlight, shone out over him. Emeralds. The large type. Not in spheres, probably cut from the gem hearts of chasm fiends hunted on the shattered plains. In a moment, Sigsel realized that the guards filling the room weren't here to get something from the quartermaster. They were here to protect this wealth.
"That's the Royal Emerald Reserve," the quartermaster said. "Held for emergency grain. Renewed with light in the storm this morning. How you talk the High Prince into letting you take it is beyond me."
"We're only borrowing them," Kaladin said. "We'll have them back before evening arrives. They'll be warned, some will be done. We'll need to check them out tomorrow again. And the day after that."
"I could buy a princedom for that much," the quartermaster said with a grunt. "What in Kalek's name do you need them for?"
Sigsel, however, had already guessed. He grinned like a fool.
"We're going to practice being radiant."
36. Hero. 24 years ago. Dalinar cursed as smoke billowed out of the fireplace. He shoved his weight against the lever and managed to budge it, reopening the chimney flue. He coughed, backing up and waving smoke away from his face.
"We're going to need to see that replaced,"
Evie said from the sofa where she was doing needlework.
"Yeah,"
Dalinar said, thumping down to the floor before the fire.
"At least you got to it quickly. Today we will not need to scrub the walls, and the life will be as white as a sun at night."
Evie's native idioms didn't quite translate well into Alethi. The fire's heat was welcome, as Dalinar's clothing was still damp from the rains. He tried to ignore the ever-present sound of the weeping's rain outside, instead watching a pair of flame spren dance along one of the logs. These seemed vaguely human, with ever-shifting figures. He followed one with his eyes as it leaped toward the other. He heard Evie rise and thought she might be off to seek the privy again. She instead settled down next to him and took his arm, then sighed in contentment.
"It can't be comfortable," Dalinar said.
"And yet you are doing it?"
"I'm not the one who is..."
He looked at her belly, which had begun to round. Evie smiled.
"My condition does not make me so frail that I risk breaking by sitting on the floor, beloved."
She pulled his arm tighter.
"Look at them. They play so eagerly."
"It's like they're sparring," Dalinar said. "I can almost see the little blades in their hands."
"Must everything be fighting to you?"
He shrugged.
She leaned her head on his arm. "Can't you just enjoy it, Dalinar?"
"Enjoy what?"
"Your life. You went through so much to make this kingdom. Can't you be satisfied now that you've won?"
He stood up, pulling his arm from her grip and crossed the chamber to pour himself a drink.
"Don't think I haven't noticed the way you act," Evie said, "perking up whenever the king speaks of the smallest conflict beyond our borders, having the scribes read to you of great battles, always talking about the next duel."
"I'm not to have that much longer," Dalinar grumbled, then took a sip of wine. "Gavilar says it's foolish to endanger myself. Says someone is bound to try to use one of those duels as a ploy against him. I'll have to get a champion."
He stared at his wine. He'd never had a high opinion of dueling. It was too fake, too sanitized. But at least it was something.
"It's like you're dead," Evie said.
Dalinar looked over at her.
"It's like you only live when you can fight," she continued. "When you can kill. Like a blackness from old stories. You live only by taking lives from others."
With that pale hair and light golden skin, she was like a glowing gemstone. She was a sweet, loving woman who deserved better than the treatment he gave her. He forced himself to go back and sit down beside her.
"I still think the Flamespren are playing," she said.
"I've always wondered," Dalinar said. "Are they made of fire themselves? It looks like they are. And yet what of emotion spren? Are anger spren then made of anger?"
Evie nodded absently.
"And what of glory spren?" Dalinar said. "Made of glory? What is glory? Could glory spren appear around someone who is delusional, or perhaps very drunk, who only thinks they've accomplished something great, while everyone else is standing around mocking them?"
"A mystery," she said, "sent by Shishi."
"But don't you ever wonder?"
"To what end?" Evie said. "We will know eventually, when we return to the One. No use troubling our minds now about things we cannot understand."
Dalinar narrowed his eyes at the Flamespren. That one did have a sword, a miniature shard blade.
"This is why you brood so often, husband," Evie said. "It isn't healthy to have a stone curdling in your stomach, still wet with moss."
"I... what?"
"You must not think such strange thoughts. Who put such things into your mind anyway?"
He shrugged, but thought of two nights before, staying up late and drinking wine beneath the rain canopy with Gavilar and Navani. She'd talked and talked about her research into spren, and Gavilar had simply grunted while making notations in glyphs on a set of his maps. She'd spoken with such passion and excitement, and Gavilar had ignored her.
"Enjoy the moment," Evie told him. "Close your eyes and contemplate what the One has given you. Seek the peace of oblivion, and bask in the joy of your own sensation."
He closed his eyes, as she suggested, and tried to simply enjoy being here with her.
"Can a man actually change, Evie? Like those spren change?"
"We are all different aspects of the One."
"Then can you change from one aspect to another?"
"Of course," Evie said. "Is not your own doctrine about transformation? About a man being soul cast from crass to glorious?"
"I don't know if it's working."
"Then petition the One," she said.
"In prayer? Through the Ardents?"
"No, silly. Yourself."
"In person?" Dalinar asked. "Like at a temple?"
"If you wish to meet the One in person, you must travel to the valley," she said. "There you can speak with the One, or to his avatar, and be granted—"
"The old magic," Dalinar hissed, opening his eyes. "A night watcher. Evie, don't say things like that."
Storms, her pagan heritage popped up at the strangest times. She could be talking good Boren doctrine, then out came something like that. Fortunately, she spoke of it no more. She closed her eyes and hummed softly. Finally, a knock came at the outer door to his rooms. Hothan, his room steward, would answer that. Indeed, Dalinar heard the man's voice outside, and that was followed by a light rap on the chamber door.
"It's your brother, Bright Lord," Hothan said through the door.
Dalinar leaped, opening the door and passing the short master servant. Evie followed, trailing along with one hand touching the wall, a habit of hers. They passed open windows that looked down upon a sodden Kolinar, flickering lanterns marking where people moved through the streets. Gavilar waited in the sitting room, dressed in one of those new suits with the stiff jacket and buttons up the sides of the chest. His dark hair curled to his shoulders and was matched by a fine beard. Dalinar hated beards. They got caught in your helm. He couldn't deny its effect on Gavilar, though. Looking at Gavilar in his finery, one didn't see a backwater thug, a barely civilized warlord who had crushed and conquered his way to the throne. No, this man was a king. Gavilar wrapped a set of papers against the palm of his hand.
What? Dalinar asked.
Rathalas, Gavilar said, shoving the papers toward Evie as she entered.
Again?
Dalinar said. It had been years since he'd visited the Rift, that giant trench where he'd won his shard blade.
They're demanding your blade back, Gavilar said. They claim that Tanelon's heir has returned and deserves the shard as you never won it in a true contest.
Dalinar felt cold.
Now I know this to be patently false, Gavilar said, because when we fought at Rathalas all those years ago, you said you dealt with the heir. You did deal with the heir, did you not, Dalinar?
He remembered that day. He remembered darkening that doorway, the thrill pulsing inside him. He remembered a weeping child holding a shard blade, the father lying broken and dead behind. That soft voice, pleading. The thrill had vanished in a moment.
He was a child, Gavilar,
Dalinar said, his voice hoarse.
Damnation, Gavilar said. He's a descendant of the old regime. That was... Storms, that was a decade ago. He's old enough to be a threat. The whole city is going into rebellion, the entire region. If we don't act, the whole Crownlands could break off.
Dalinar smiled. The emotion shocked him, and he quickly stifled the grin.
But surely, surely someone would need to go and rout the rebels?
He turned and caught sight of Evie. She was beaming at him, though he'd have expected her to be indignant at the idea of more wars. Instead, she stepped up to him and took his arm.
You spared the child.
He could barely lift the blade. I gave him to his mother and told her to hide him.
Oh, Dalinar.
She pulled him close. He felt a swelling of pride. Ridiculous, of course. He had endangered the kingdom. How would people react if they knew the Blackthorn himself had broken before a crisis of conscience? They'd laugh. In that moment, he didn't care, so long as he could be a hero to this woman.
Well, I suppose rebellion was to be expected, Gavilar said as he stared out the window. It's been years since the formal unification. People are going to start asserting their independence.
He raised his hand toward Dalinar, turning.
I know what you want, brother, but you'll have to forbear. I'm not sending an army, but I can nip this thing with politics. We can't have a show of force be our only method of maintaining unity, or Elokar will spend his entire life putting out fires after I'm gone. We need people to start thinking of Alethkar as a unified kingdom, not separate regions always looking for an advantage against one another.
Sounds good, Dalinar said. It wasn't going to happen, not without the sword to remind them. For once, however, he was fine not being the one to point that out. 37. The Last Time We March. You mustn't worry yourself about race. It is a pity about Iona and Skye, but they were foolish, violating our pact from the very beginning. Numuhuku Makiakia I Alunamor had always been taught that the first rule of warfare was to know your enemy. One might assume that such lessons weren't terribly relevant in his life anymore. Fortunately, making a good stew was a lot like going to war. Lunamor, called Rock by his friends, on account of their thick, lowlander tongues being incapable of proper speech, stirred his cauldron with an enormous wooden spoon the size of a longsword. A fire burned rockbud husks underneath, and a playful windspren whipped at the smoke, making it blow across him no matter where he stood. He had placed the cauldron on a plateau of the shattered plains, and, beautiful lights and fallen stars, he was surprised to discover that he had missed this place. Who would have thought he could become fond of this barren, windswept flatland? His homeland was a place of extremes, bitter ice, powdery snow, boiling heat, and blessed humidity. Down here everything was so moderate, and the shattered plains were the worst of all. In Yakaved he'd found vine-covered valleys. In Alethkar they had fields of grain, rock buds spreading endlessly like the bubbles of a boiling cauldron. Then the shattered plains. Endless, empty plateaus with barely anything growing on them. Strangely, he loved them. Lunamor hummed softly as he stirred with two hands, churning the stew and keeping the bottom from burning. When the smoke wasn't in his face, this cursed too-thick wind had too much air to behave properly, he could smell the scent of the shattered plains. An open scent. The scent of a high sky and baking stones, but spiced by the hint of life in the chasms. Like a pinch of salt. Humid, alive with the odors of plants and rot intermingling. In those chasms, Lunamor had found himself again after a long time being lost. Renewed life, renewed purpose. And stew. Lunamor tasted his stew, using a fresh spoon, of course, as he wasn't a barbarian like some of these lowlander cooks. The longroots still had further to cook before he could add the meat. Real meat, from finger crabs he'd spent all night shelling. Couldn't cook that too long, or it got rubbery. The rest of Bridge Four stood arrayed on the plateau, listening to Kaladin. Lunamor had set up so that his back was toward Narok, the city at the center of the shattered plains. Nearby, one of the plateaus flashed as Renar and Kolin worked the Oath Gate. Lunamor tried not to be distracted by that. He wanted to look out westward, toward the old war camps. Not much longer now to wait, he thought. But don't dwell on that. The stew needs more crushed limb. I trained many of you in the chasms, Kaladin said. The men of Bridge Four had been augmented by some members of the other bridge crews and even a couple of soldiers that Dalinar had suggested for training. The group of five scout women was surprising, but who was Lunamor to judge? I could train people in the spear, Kaladin continued, because I myself had been trained in the spear. What we're attempting today is different. I barely understand how I learned to use Stormlight. We're going to have to stumble through this together.
It's all good, Goncho, Lopin called. How hard can it be to learn how to fly? Sky eels do it all the time, and they are ugly and stupid. Most bridgemen are only one of those things.
Kaladin stopped in line near Lopin. The captain seemed in good spirits today, for which Lunamor took credit. He had, after all, made Kaladin's breakfast. The first step will be to speak the ideal, Kaladin said. I suspect a few of you have already said it. But for the rest, if you wish to be a squire to the Windrunners, you will need to swear it. They began belting out the words. Everyone knew the right ones by now. Lunamor whispered the ideal.
Life before death, strength before weakness, journey before destination.
Kaladin handed Lopin a pouch full of gemstones. The real test and proof of your squireship will be learning to draw Stormlight into yourselves. A few of you have learned it already. Lopin started glowing immediately. And they will help the rest learn. Lopin, take first, second, and third squads. Sigzil, you've got fourth, fifth, and sixth. Pete, don't think I haven't seen you glowing. You take the other bridgemen. And Teft,
You take the scouts and— Kaladin looked around. Where is Taft?
He was only just noticing. Lunamore loved their captain, but he got distracted sometimes. Maybe air sickness.
Taft didn't come back to the barracks last night, sir, Layton called, looking uncomfortable.
Fine, I'll help the scouts. Lopin, Sigzil, Pete, talk your squads through how to draw in Stormlight. Before the day is done, I want everyone on this plateau glowing like they swallowed a lantern.
They broke up, obviously eager. Translucent red streamers rose from the stone, whipping as if in the wind, one end connected to the ground. Anticipation sprang. Lunamore gave them the sign of respect, hand to his shoulder, then his forehead. These were lesser gods, but still holy. He could see their true shapes beyond the streamers, a faint shadow of a larger creature at the bottom. Lunamore handed off his stirring to Dabid. The young bridgeman didn't talk, and hadn't since Lunamore had helped Kaladin pull him from the battlefield. He could stir, though, and run water skins. He had become something of an unofficial mascot for the team, as he'd been the first bridgeman that Kaladin had saved. When bridgemen passed Dabid, they gave a subtle salute. Huio was on kitchen duty with Lunamore today, as was becoming more common. Huio requested it, and the others avoided it. The squat, beefy Herdazian man was humming softly to himself as he stirred the shiki, a brownish horn-eater drink that Lunamore had chilled overnight in metal bins on the plateau outside Urethiru. Strangely, Huio took a handful of lasbo from a pot and sprinkled it into the liquid.
"What are you doing, crazy man?"
Lunamore bellowed, stomping up.
"Lasbo? In drink? That thing is spicy powder, airsick lowlander!"
Huio said something in Herdazian.
"Bah," Lunamore said. "I do not speak this crazy language you use. Lopan, come here and talk to this cousin you have. He is ruining our drinks."
Lopan, however, was gesturing wildly at the sky and talking about how he'd stuck himself to the ceiling earlier. Lunamore grunted and looked back at Huio, who proffered a spoon dripping with liquid.
"Air sick fool," Lunamore said, taking a sip. "You will ruin—"
Blessed gods of sea and stone, that was good.
The spice added just the right kick to the chilled drink, combining flavors in a completely unexpected yet somehow complimentary way. Huio smiled.
"Bridge four," he said in thickly accented Alethi.
"You are lucky man," Lunamore said, pointing. "I will not kill you today."
He took another sip, then gestured with the spoon.
"Go do this thing to other bins of Shiki."
Now where was Haber? The lanky, gap-toothed man couldn't be too far away. That was one advantage of having an assistant chef who could not walk. He usually stayed where you put him.
"Watch me now, carefully,"
Lopin said to his group, Stormlight puffing from his mouth as he spoke.
"All right, here it is. I, the Lopin, will now fly. You may applaud as you feel is appropriate."
He jumped up and then crashed back to the plateau.
"Lopin," Kaladin called. "You're supposed to be helping the others, not showing off." "Sorry, Gon," Lopin said.
He quivered on the ground, his face pressed to the stone, and didn't rise.
Did you stick yourself to the ground?" Kaladin asked. "Just part of the plan, Gon," Lopin called back. "If I am to become a delicate cloud upon the sky, I must first convince the ground that I am not abandoning her. Like a worried lover, sure, she must be comforted and reassured that I will return following my dramatic and regal ascent to the sky."
"You're not a king, Lopin," Dreyi said. "We've been over this."
"Of course I am not. I am a former king. You are obviously one of the stupid ones I mentioned earlier."
Lunamore grunted in amusement and rounded his little cooking station toward Haber, who he now remembered was peeling tubers by the side of the plateau. Lunamore slowed. Why was Kaladin kneeling before Haber's stool, holding out
A gemstone? Ah, Lunamore thought.
I had to breathe to draw it in, Kaladin explained softly. I'd been doing it unconsciously for weeks, maybe months, before Teft explained the truth to me.
Sir, Haber said, I don't know if... I mean, sir, I'm no Radiant. I was never that good with the spear. I'm barely a passable cook.
Passable was a stretch. But he was earnest and helpful, so Lunamore was happy to have him. Besides, he needed a job he could do sitting. A month back, the assassin in white had swept through the king's palace at the war camps trying to kill Elokar, and the attack had left Haber with dead legs. Kaladin folded the gemstone in Haber's fingers.
Just try, the captain said softly. Being a Radiant isn't so much about your strength or skill, but about your heart. And yours is the best of all of us.
The captain seemed intimidating to many outsiders, a perpetual storm for an expression, an intensity that made men wilt when it turned on them. But there was also an astonishing tenderness to this man. Kaladin gripped Haber on the arm and almost seemed to be tearing up. Some days it seemed you couldn't break Kaladin's Stormblessed with all the stones on Roshar. Then one of his men would get wounded, and you'd see him crack. Kaladin headed back toward the scouts he'd been helping, and Lunamore jogged to catch up. He bowed to the little god who rode on the bridge captain's shoulder, then asked,
You think Haber can do this thing, Kaladin?
I'm sure he can. I'm sure all of Bridge Four can. And perhaps some of these others.
Ha! Huh, Lunamore said. Finding a smile on your face, Kaladin Stormblessed, is like finding lost sphere in your soup. Surprising, yes. But very nice, too. Come. I have drink you must try.
I need to get back to...
Come. Drink you must try.
Lunamore guided him to the big pot of shiki and poured him a cup. Kaladin slurped it down.
Hey, that's pretty good, Rock.
Is not my recipe, Lunamore said. Huyo has changed this thing. I now have to either promote him or push him outside a plateau.
Promote him to what? Kaladin asked, getting himself another cup.
To airsick lowlander, Lunamore said. Second class.
You might be too fond of that term, Rock.
Nearby, Lopin talked to the ground, against which he was still pressed.
Don't worry, dear one. The Lopin is vast enough to be possessed by many, many forces, both terrestrial and celestial. I must soar to the air, for if I were to remain only on the ground, surely my growing magnitude would cause the land to crack and break.
Lunamore looked to Kaladin.
I am fond of term, yes, but only because this thing has astounding number of applications among you.
Kaladin grinned, sipping his shiki and watching the men. Farther along the plateau, Drahi suddenly raised his long arms and called out,
Ha!
He was glowing with stormlight. Bissig soon followed. That should fix his hand. He too had been injured by the assassin in white.
This will work, Rock, Kaladin said. The men have been close to the power for months now, and once they have it, they'll be able to heal. I won't have to go into battle worrying which of you I'll lose.
Kaladin, Lunamore said softly, this thing we have begun, it is still war. Men will die.
Bridge Four will be protected by their power.
And the enemy? They will not have power?
He stepped closer.
Surely I do not wish to dampen Kaladin Stormblessed when he is optimistic, but nobody is ever perfectly safe. This is sad truth, my friend.
Maybe, Kaladin admitted.
He got a distant look on his face.
Your people only let younger sons go to war, right?
Only Twanalekina, fourth son and younger, can be wasted in war. First, second, and third sons are too valuable.
Fourth son and younger, so hardly ever.
Huh? You do not know the size of Horn-Eater families.
Still, it has to mean fewer men dying in battle.
Peaks are different place
Lunamore said, smiling at Silfrenna as she rose off Kaladin's shoulder and started dancing on the nearby winds.
And not just because we have right amount of air for brains to work. To attack another peak is costly and difficult, requiring much preparation and time. We speak of this thing more than we do him.
Sounds nice.
You will visit with me someday, Lunamore said. You and all Bridge Four, as you are family now.
Ground, Lopin insisted. I will still love you. I'm not attracted to anyone the way I am to you. Whenever I leave, I'll come right back.
Kaladin glanced at Lunamore.
Perhaps, Lunamore noted, when that one is away from too much toxic air, he will be less...
Lopin?
Oh, upon consideration, this thing would be sad.
Kaladin chuckled, handing Lunamore his cup. Then he leaned in.
What happened to your brother, Rock?
My two brothers are well, so far as I know.
And the third brother?
Kaladin said. The one who died, moving you from fourth to third and making you a cook instead of a soldier?
Don't deny it.
His sad story, Lunamore said. And today is not day for sad stories. Today is day for laughter, stew, flight, these things.
And hopefully something even grander. Kaladin patted him on the shoulder.
If you ever need to talk, I'm here.
That is good to know. Though today, I believe someone else wishes to talk.
Lunamore nodded toward someone crossing a bridge onto their plateau. A figure in a stiff blue uniform, with a silver circlet on his head.
The king has been eager to speak with you. Ha! Huh? Asked us several times if we knew when you would return. As if we are appointment keepers for our glorious flying leader.
Yes, Kaladin said.
He came to see me the other day. Kaladin braced himself visibly, setting his jaw, then walked to the king, who had just marched onto the plateau, trailed by a cluster of guards from Bridge 11. Lunamore positioned himself, working on the soup where he could listen, as he was curious.
Windrunner, Elokar said, nodding to Kaladin. It seems you are right. Your men have had their powers restored. How soon will they be ready?
They're in fighting shape already, Your Majesty. But to master their powers... Well, I can't say, honestly.
Lunamore sipped his soup and didn't turn toward the king, but stirred and listened.
Have you given thought to my request? Elokar said. Will you fly me to Kolinar, so we can reclaim the city?
I'll do as my commander tells me.
No, Elokar said. I'm asking you personally. Will you come? Will you help me reclaim our homeland?
Yes, Kaladin said softly. Give me some time, a few weeks at least, to train my men. I prefer to bring a few Squire Windrunners with us, and if we're lucky, I might be able to leave a full Radiant behind to lead if something happens to me. But either way, yes, Elokar. I'll go with you to Alethkar.
Good. We have some time, as Uncle wishes to try contacting people in Kolinar using his visions. Perhaps 20 days? Can you train your squires in that time?
I'll have to, Your Majesty.
Lunamore glanced at the king, who folded his arms, watching the Windrunners, prospective and current. He seemed to have come not just to speak with Kaladin, but to watch the training. Kaladin walked back to the scouts, his god following in the air after him. So Lunamore brought the king something to drink. Then he hesitated beside the bridge that Elokar had crossed to reach this plateau. Their old bridge from the bridge runs had been repurposed for moving people around these plateaus closest to Narok. Permanent bridges were still being reconstructed. Lunamore patted the wood. They'd thought this lost, but a salvage party had discovered it wedged in a chasm a short distance away. Dalinar had agreed to have it hauled up at Teft's request. Considering what it had been through, the old bridge was in good shape. It was made of tough wood, Bridge 4 was. He looked beyond it and was unsettled by the sight of the next plateau over, or the rubble of it. A stump of a plateau, made of broken rock that extended only 20 feet or so from the chasm floor. Verlaine said that had been an ordinary plateau before the meeting of Everstorm and Highstorm at the Battle of Narok. During that terrible cataclysm, when storms met, entire plateaus had been ripped up and shattered. Though the Everstorm had returned several times, the two storms had not again met over a populated area. Lunamore patted the old bridge, then shook his head, walking back toward his cooking station. They could have trained at Uathiru, perhaps, but none of the bridgemen had complained at coming here. The shattered plains were far better than the lonesome plain before the tower. This place was just as barren, but it was also theirs. They also hadn't questioned when Lunamore had decided to bring along his cauldrons and supplies to make lunch. It was inefficient, true, but a hot meal would make up for it, and beyond that, there was an unspoken rule. Though Lunamore, Dabbit, and Haber didn't participate in the training or sparring, they were still Bridge Four. They went where the others went. He had Huyo add the meat, with a strict charge to ask before changing any spices. Dabbit continued to stir placidly. He seemed content, though it was hard to tell with that one. Lunamore washed his hands in a pot, then got to work on the bread. Cooking was like warfare. You had to know your enemy, though his enemies in this contest were his friends. They came to each meal expecting greatness, and Lunamore fought to prove himself time and time again. He waged war with breads and soups, sating appetites and satisfying stomachs. As he worked, hands deep within the dough, he could hear his mother's humming, her careful instructions. Kaladin was wrong. Lunamore hadn't become a cook. He'd always been one, since he could toddle up the step stool to the counter and stick his fingers in the sticky dough. Yes, he'd once trained with a bow, but soldiers needed to eat, and Nuatoma guards each did several jobs, even guards with his particular heritage and blessings. He closed his eyes, kneading and humming his mother's song to a beat he could almost barely, just faintly hear. A short time later, he heard soft footsteps crossing the bridge behind. Prince Renarin stopped beside the cauldron, his duty of transferring people through the Oath Gate finished for now. On the plateau, more than a third of Bridge Four had figured out how to draw in stormlight, but none of the newcomers had managed it, despite Kaladin's coaching. Renarin watched with flushed cheeks. He'd obviously run to get here once released from his other duty, but now he was hesitant. Elokar had set up to watch near some rocks, and Renarin stepped toward him as if sitting at the side and watching was his place, too.
"Hey!"
Lunamore said.
"Renarin!"
Renarin jumped. The boy wore his blue Bridge Four uniform, though his seemed somehow neater than the others.
"I could use some help with this bread," Lunamore said.
Renarin smiled immediately. All the youth ever wanted was to be treated like the rest of them. Well, that attitude benefited a man. Lunamore would have the High Prince himself kneading dough if he could get away with it. Dalinar seemed like he could use a good session of making bread. Renarin washed his hands, then sat on the ground across from Lunamore and followed his lead. Lunamore ripped off a piece of dough about as wide as his hand, flattened it, then slapped it against one of the large stones he'd put to warm by the fire. The dough stuck to the stone, where it would cook until one peeled it off. Lunamore didn't push Renarin to talk. Some people you wanted to press, draw them out. Others you wanted to let move at their own pace. Like the difference between a stew you brought to a boil and one you kept at a simmer.
"But where is his god?"
Lunamore could see all Spren. Prince Renarin had bonded one, except Lunamore had never been able to spot it. He bowed when Renarin wasn't looking, just in case, and made a sign of reverence to the hidden god.
"Bridge Four's doing well," Renarin finally said. "You'll have them all drinking stormlight soon."
"Like Liso,"
Lunamore said.
"Ha! But they have much time until they catch up to you."
"Truth Watcher is good name,
More people should watch truth instead of lies. Renarin blushed.
I suppose it means I can't be in Bridge 4 anymore, doesn't it?
Why not?
I'm a different order of Radiant, Renarin said, eyes down as he formed a perfectly round piece of dough, then carefully set it onto a stone.
You have power to heal.
The surges of progression and illumination. I'm not sure how to make the second one work, though. Shallan has explained it 7 times, but I can't create even the smallest illusion. Something's wrong.
Still, only healing for now? This thing will be very useful to Bridge 4.
I can't be Bridge 4 anymore.
That is nonsense. Bridge 4 is not Windrunners.
Then what is it?
It is us, Lunamore said. It is me. It is them. It is you.
He nodded toward David.
That one. He will never hold spear again. He will not fly, but he is Bridge 4. I am forbidden to fight, but I am Bridge 4. And you? You might have fancy title and different powers.
He leaned forward.
But I know Bridge 4. And you, Renarin Kholin, are Bridge 4.
Renarin smiled widely. But, Rock, don't you ever worry that you aren't the person everyone thinks you are?
Everyone thinks I am loud, insufferable lout, Lunamore said. So to be something else would not be bad thing.
Renarin chuckled.
You think this about yourself, Lunamore said.
Maybe, Renarin said, making another perfectly round piece of dough. I don't know what I am most days, Rock, but I seem to be the only one. Since I could walk, everyone was saying, look how bright he is, he should be an Ardent. Lunamore grunted. Sometimes, even if you were loud and insufferable, you knew when not to say anything. Everyone thinks it's so obvious. I have a mind for figures, don't I? Yes, join the Ardents. Of course, nobody says I'm much less of a man than my brother, and nobody points out that it sure would be nice for the succession if the sickly, strange younger brother were safely tucked away in a monastery.
When you say these things, you are almost not bitter, Lunamore said. Ah, much practice must have been required.
A lifetime.
Tell me, Lunamore said, why do you wish to be man who fights, Renarin Kholin?
Because it's what my father always wanted, Renarin said immediately. He may not realize it, but it's there, Rock. Lunamore grunted.
Perhaps this is stupid reason, but it is reason, and I can respect that. But tell me, why do you not want to become Ardent or Storm Warden?
Because everyone assumes I will be, Renarin said, slapping bread down on the heated stones. If I go and do it, I'm giving in to what they all say. He looked for something to fidget with, and Lunamore tossed him more dough.
I think, Lunamore said, your problem is different than you say. You claim you are not the person everyone thinks you are. Maybe you worry instead that you are that person.
A sickly weakling.
No, Lunamore said, leaning in. You can be you without this being bad thing. You can admit you act and think differently from your brother, but can learn not to see this as flaw. It is just Renarin Kholin.
Renarin started kneading the dough furiously.
Is good, Lunamore said, that you learn to fight. Men do well learning many different skills, but men also do well using what the gods have given them. In the peaks, a man may not have such choices. His privilege.
I suppose. Gliss says, well, it's complicated. I could talk to the Ardents, but I'm hesitant to do anything that would make me stand out from the other Bridgemen, Rock. I'm already the oddest one in this bunch.
Is that so?
Don't deny it, Rock. Lopin is, well, Lopin. And you're obviously, you. But I'm still the strange one. I've always been the strangest one. Lunamore slapped dough onto a rock, then pointed toward where Verlaine, the Parshendi bridgeman they used to call Shen, sat on a rock near his squad, watching quietly as the others laughed at Eth, having accidentally stuck a stone to his hand. He wore war form and so was taller and stronger than he had been before, but the humans seemed to have completely forgotten that he was there.
"Oh," Renarin said, "I don't know if he counts."
"This thing is what everyone always tells him," Lunamore said. "Over and over again."
Renarin stared for a long time while Lunamore continued to make bread. Finally, Renarin stood up and dusted off his uniform, walked across the stone plateau, and settled down beside Verlaine. Renarin fidgeted and didn't say anything, but Verlaine seemed to appreciate the company anyway. Lunamore smiled, then finished the last of the bread. He rose and set up the shiki drink with a stack of wooden cups. He took another drink himself, then shook his head and glanced at Huyo, who was harvesting the bread. The Herdazian man was glowing faintly. Clearly, he'd already learned how to draw in stormlight. "Air-sick Herdazian!" Lunamore raised a hand, and Huyo tossed him a flatbread, which Lunamore bit. He chewed the warm bread, thoughtful.
"More salt in the next batch."
The Herdazian just kept harvesting the bread.
"You do think they need more salt, don't you?" Lunamore said.
Huyo shrugged.
"Add more salt to that batch that I've started mixing," Lunamore said. "And do not look so self-satisfied. I may still throw you offside a plateau."
Huyo smiled and kept working. The men soon started coming over for something to drink. They grinned, thumped Lunamore on the back, told him he was a genius. But of course none remembered that he had tried serving them shiki once before. They had mostly left it in the cauldron, opting for beer instead. That day they hadn't been hot, sweaty, and frustrated. Know your enemy. Out here, with the right drink, he was a little god unto himself.
Ha! A god of cool drinks and friendly advice.
Any chef worth his spoons learned to talk because cooking was an art, and art was subjective. One man could love an ice sculpture while another thought it boring. It was the same with food and drink. It did not make the food broken or the person broken to not be liked. He chatted with Leighton, who was still shaken by their experience with the dark god below Uathiru. Powerful god that had been, and very vengeful. There were legends of such things in the peaks. Lunamore's great-great-great-grandfather had met with one while traveling the Third Divide. Excellent and important story, which Lunamore did not share today. He calmed Leighton, commiserated with him. The thick-bodied armorer was a fine man and could talk as loudly as Lunamore sometimes.
Ha! You could hear him two plateaus away, which Lunamore liked. What was the point of a little voice? Weren't voices for being heard?
Leighton went back to his practice, but others had their worries. Scar was the best spearman among them, particularly now that Moash had left, but was feeling self-conscious at not having drawn in Stormlight. Lunamore asked Scar to show him what he'd learned, and, after Scar's instruction, Lunamore actually managed to draw some in himself, to his delight and surprise. Scar left with a spring to his step. Another man would have felt worse, but Scar was a teacher at heart. The short man still hoped that Lunamore would someday choose to fight. He was the only one of the bridgemen who actively spoke out about Lunamore's pacifism. Once the men had been thoroughly watered, Lunamore found himself looking out across the plateaus for some sign of movement in the distance. Well, best to keep busy with the meal. The stew was perfect. He was pleased to have been able to get the crabs. So much of what everyone ate in the tower was of soul-cast grain or meat, neither of which was very appetizing. The flatbread had cooked up nicely, and he'd even been able to concoct a chutney last night. Now he just had to... Lunamore almost stumbled into his own cauldron as he saw what was assembling on the plateau to his left.
Gods. Strong gods, like Silfrenna.
Glowing a faint blue, they clustered around a tall Spren woman who had long hair streaming behind her. She had taken the shape of a person, human-sized, and wore an elegant gown. The others swirled about in the air, though their focus was obviously the practicing bridgemen and hopefuls.
Uma ame tokuma mafaliki,
Lunamore started, hastily making the signs of respect. Then, to be sure, he got down on his knees and bowed. He had never seen so many in one place. Even his occasional meeting with an afaliki in the peaks did not hit him as hard as this. What was the proper offering? He could not give only bows for such a sight as this, but bread and stew? Mafaliki would not want bread and stew.
You, a feminine voice said beside him, are so wonderfully respectful, it borders on being silly.
Lunamore turned to find Silfrenna sitting on the side of his cauldron in her small and girlish shape, legs crossed and hanging over the edge. He made the sign again.
They are your kin? Is this woman at their front your Nuatoma, Ali'i Kamura?
Kind of, maybe, sort of halfway, she said, cocking her head. I can barely remember a voice, her voice, Benderana, reprimanding me. I got in so much trouble for searching out Kaladin. Yet, here they are. They won't speak to me. I think they assume that if they do, they'd have to admit to me they were wrong.
She leaned forward, grinning.
And they absolutely hate being wrong.
Lunamore nodded solemnly.
You're not as brown as you were,
Silfrenna said.
Yes, my tan is fading, Lunamore said. Too much time indoors, Mafaliki.
Humans can change colors?
Some more than others, Lunamore said, holding up his hand. Some from other peaks are pale, like Shin, though my peak has always been more bronze.
You look like somebody washed you way too much, Silfrenna said. They took a scrub brush to you and rubbed your skin off, and that's why your hair is red, because you got so sore.
These are wise words, Lunamore said.
He wasn't sure why yet. He'd have to ponder them. He fished in his pocket for the spheres that he had on him, which weren't many. Still, he arranged each one in its own bowl and then approached the assemblage of Spren. There had to be 24 or more of them. Kali Kalinda! The other bridgemen couldn't see the gods, of course. He wasn't sure what Huyo or Haber thought of him walking reverently across the plateau, then bowing himself and arranging the bowls with their spheres as offerings. When he looked up, the Ali'i Kamura, the most important god here, was studying him. She rested her hand over one of the bowls and drew out the stormlight. Then she left, turning into a streak of light and zipping away. The others remained, a mottled collection of clouds, ribbons, people, bunches of leaves, and other natural objects. They flittered overhead, watching the practicing men and women. Silfrenna crossed the air to stand beside Lunamore's head.
They are looking, Lunamore whispered. This thing is happening. Not just bridgemen, not just squires. Radiance, as Kaladin wishes.
We'll see,
she said, then huffed softly before zipping away as a ribbon of light herself. Lunamore left the bowls in case any of the others wished to partake of his offering. At his cook station, he stacked up the flatbread, intending to give the plates to Haber to hold and distribute. Only Haber didn't respond to his request. The lanky man sat on his little stool, leaning forward, his hand in a tight fist that glowed from the gemstone inside. The cups he'd been washing lay in an ignored stack beside him. Haber's mouth moved, whispering, and he stared at that glowing fist in the same way a man might stare at the tinder in his fire pit on a very cold night surrounded by snow. Desperation, determination, prayer.
Do it, Haber, Lunamore thought, stepping forward. Drink it in. Make it yours. Claim it.
Lunamore felt an energy to the air, a moment of focus. Several windspren turned toward Haber, and for a heartbeat Lunamore thought that everything else faded. Haber became one man alone in a darkened place, fist glowing. He stared unblinking at that sign of power, that sign of redemption. The light in Haber's fist went out.
Ha!
Lunamore shouted.
Ha!
Haber jumped in surprise. His jaw dropped and he stared at the now done gemstone. Then he held up his hand, gawking at the luminescent smoke that rose from it.
Guys!
He called.
Guys! Guys!
Lunamore stepped back as the bridgemen left their stations and came rushing over.
Give him your gemstones, Kaladin called. He's going to need a lot. Pile them up!
Bridgemen scrambled to give Haber their emeralds, and he drew in more and more stormlight. Then the light suddenly dampened.
I can feel them again,
Haber cried.
I can feel my toes!
He tentatively reached out for support. Drey under one arm, Pete under the other, Haber slipped off his stool and stood up. He grinned with a gap-toothed expression and almost fell over. His legs obviously weren't very strong. Drey and Pete righted him, but he forced them back to let him stand precariously on his own. The men of Bridge Four waited only briefly before pressing in with cries of excitement. Joy Spren swirled around the group like a sweeping gust of blue leaves. Amid them, Lopin shoved in close and made the Bridge Four salute. It seemed to mean something special coming from him. Two arms. One of the first times Lopin had been able to make the salute. Haber saluted back, grinning like a boy who just hit his first center shot with the bow. Kaladin stepped up beside Lunamore, Silfrenna on his shoulder.
It will work, Rock. This will protect them.
Lunamore nodded, then by habit checked toward the west as he'd been doing all day. This time he spotted something. It looked like a plume of smoke. Kaladin flew to check it out. Lunamore, along with the rest of them, followed along on the ground, carrying their mobile bridge. Lunamore ran at the center front of the bridge. It smelled of memories. The wood, the stain used to seal it, the sounds of several dozen men grunting and breathing in enclosed spaces, the slapping of feet on plateau, mixed exhaustion and terror, an assault, arrows flying, men dying. Lunamore had known what might happen when he chose to come down from the peaks with Kefha. No Nuatoma from the peaks had ever yet won a shardblade or shardplate from the Alethi or Vaidens they challenged. Still, Kefha had determined the cost was worth the risk. At worst, he had thought he would end up dead, and his family would become servants to a wealthy lowlander. They hadn't anticipated the cruelty of Toral Sadius, who had murdered Kefha without a proper duel, killed many of Lunamore's family who resisted, and seized his property. Lunamore roared, charging forward, and his skin started to glow with the power of the stormlight from his pouch and the spheres he had collected before leaving. He seemed to be carrying the bridge all on his own, towing the others. Scar called out a marching song, and Bridge Four thundered the words. Bridge Four had grown strong enough to carry the bridge long distances without difficulty, but this day put those previous runs to shame. They ran at a sprint the entire distance, vibrant with stormlight, Lunamore calling the commands as Kaladin or Teft had once done. When they reached a chasm, they practically tossed the bridge across. When they picked it up on the other side, it seemed light as a reed. It felt like they'd barely started going before they neared the source of the smoke, a beleaguered caravan crossing the plains. Lunamore threw his weight against the bridge's outer support rods, pushing it across the chasm, then he charged over. Others followed. Dabbit and Lopin unhooked shields and spears from the side of the bridge and tossed one to each bridgeman as they passed. They fell into squads, and the men who normally followed Teft fell in behind Lunamore, though he had, of course, refused the spear Lopin tried to toss him. Many of the caravan wagons had been transporting lumber from the forests outside the war camps, though some were piled high with furniture. Dalinar Kolin spoke of repopulating his war camp, but the two high princes who remained behind had been encroaching on the land, quietly, like eels. For now, it was best to scavenge what they could and bring it to Yuathiru. The caravan had been using Dalinar's large wheeled bridges to cross chasms. Lunamore passed one of these, lying on its side, broken. Three of the large lumber wagons near it had been set afire, making the air acrid with smoke. Kaladin floated overhead, holding his brilliant shard spear. Lunamor squinted through the smoke in the direction Kaladin was looking and made out figures streaking away through the sky.
"Voidbringer attack," Drahi muttered. "We should have guessed they'd start raiding our caravans."
Lunamor didn't care at the moment. He pushed his way through weary caravan guards and frightened merchants hiding under wagons. There were bodies everywhere. The Voidbringers had killed dozens. Lunamor searched through the mess, trembling. Was that red hair on a corpse? No, that was blood soaking a headscarf. And that other body wasn't human. It had marbled skin. A brilliant white arrow stuck from its back, fletched with goose feathers. An Unkalaki arrow. Lunamor looked to the right, where someone had piled up furniture in a heap almost like a fortification. A head poked up over the top, a stout woman with a round face and a deep red braid. She stood up tall and raised a bow toward Lunamor. Other faces peeked out from behind the furniture. Two youths, a boy and a girl, both around 16. Younger faces from there, 6 in total. Lunamor dashed toward them and found himself blubbering, tears streaming down his cheeks as he crawled up the outside of their improvised fortification. His family, at long last, had arrived at the shattered plains.
"This is Song,"
Lunamor said, pulling the woman close, one arm around her shoulders.
"His best woman in all the peaks. Ha! We made snow forts as childs, and hers was always best. I should have known to find her in castle, even if it was made of old chairs."
"Snow?" Lopin asked. "How do you make forts out of snow? I've heard all about this stuff. It's like frost, right?"
"Air sick, Lowlander."
Lunamor shook his head, moving to the twins. He put one hand on each of their shoulders.
"Boy is gift. Girl is cord.
Ah!
When I left, gift was short like scar. Now he is nearly my height."
He struggled to keep the pain from his voice. It had been almost a year. So long. Originally, his intent had been to bring them as soon as possible. But then everything had gone wrong. Satius, the bridge crews.
"Next son is Rock, but not same kind of Rock as me. This is, smaller Rock. Third son is Star. Second daughter is Kumatiki. It's kind of shell. You do not have him here. Last daughter is another Song. Beautiful Song."
He stooped down beside her, smiling. She was only 4, and she shied away from him. She didn't remember her father. It broke his heart. Song, Tuakalina Kalminor, put her hand on his back. Nearby, Kaladin introduced Bridge 4, but only Gift and Cord had been taught Lowlander languages, and Cord spoke only Vaden. Gift managed a passable greeting in Alethi. Little Song sought her mother's legs. Lunamor blinked away tears, though they were not completely sad tears. His family was here. His first saved wages had paid for the message, sent by Spanreed to the Peak's message station. That station was still a week's travel from his home, and from there, traveling down from the slopes and crossing Alethkar took months. Around them, the caravan was finally limping into motion. This was the first chance Lunamor had found to introduce his family, as Bridge 4 had spent the last half hour trying to help the wounded. Then Renarin had arrived with Adolin and 2 companies of troops, and for all Renarin's worries about not being useful, his healing had saved several lives. Tuaka rubbed Lunamor's back, then knelt down beside him, pulling their daughter close with one arm, Lunamor with the other.
"It was a long journey," she said in Ukalaki. "And longest at the end, when those things came from the sky."
"I should have come to the war camps," Lunamor said, "to escort you."
"We're here now," she said. "Lunamor, what happened? Your note was so terse. Kepha is dead? But what happened to you? Why so long without word?"
He bowed his head. How could he explain this? The bridge runs, the cracks in his soul. How could he explain that the man she'd always said was so strong had wished to die, had been a coward, had given up near the end?
What of Tifi and Sinakua?
She asked him.
Dead,
he whispered.
They raised weapons in vengeance.
She put her hand to her lips. She wore a glove on her safe hand in deference to silly Boran traditions.
Then you...
I am a chef now, Lunamore said, firm.
But I cook,
Tuaka. He pulled her close again.
Come, let us take the children to safety. We will reach the tower, which you will like. It is like the peaks, almost. I will tell you stories. Some are painful.
Very well. Lunamore, I have stories too. The peaks are home. Something is wrong. Very wrong.
He pulled back and met her eyes. They'd call her dark-eyed down here, though he found infinite depth, beauty, and light in those deep brown-green eyes.
I will explain when we are safe,
she promised, picking up little beautiful song.
You are wise to usher us forward, wise as ever.
No, my love, he whispered. I am a fool. I would blame the air, but I was a fool above, too. A fool to ever let Kefa leave on this errand of stupidity.
She walked the children across the bridge. He watched and was glad to hear Unkalaki again, a proper language. Glad that the other men did not speak it. For if they did, they might have picked out the lies that he had told them. Kaladin stepped up, clapping him on the shoulder.
I'm going to assign your family my rooms, Rock. I've been slow in getting family quarters for the bridgemen. This will light a fire under me. I'll get us an assignment, and until then I'll bunk with the rest of the men.
Lunamore opened his mouth to object, then thought better of it. Some days the more honorable thing was to take a gift without complaint.
Thank you, he said. For the rooms. For other things, my captain.
Go walk with your family, Rock. We can handle the bridge without you today. We have Stormlight.
Lunamore rested his fingers on the smooth wood.
No, he said. It will be a privilege to carry him one last time. For my family.
One last time? Kaladin said.
We take to the skies, Storm-blessed, Lunamore said. We will walk no more in coming days. This is the end.
He looked back toward a subdued Bridge Four group who seemed to sense that what he said was true.
Ah, do not look so sad. I left Great Stew back near city. Haber will probably not ruin it before we return. Come, pick up our bridge. The last time, we marched not toward death, but toward full stomachs and good songs.
Despite his urging, it was a solemn, respectful group who lifted the bridge. They were slaves no longer. Storms in their pockets, they carried riches. It glowed fiercely, and soon their skin did as well. Kaladin took his place at the front. Together they carried the bridge on one final run, reverently, as if it were the bier of a king being taken to his tomb for his eternal rest. 38. Broken People. Your skills are admirable, but you are merely a man. You had your chance to be more and refused it. Dalinar entered the next vision in the middle of a fight. He had learned his lesson. He didn't intend to mire another person in an unexpected battle. This time he intended to find a safe point, then bring people in. That meant appearing as he had many months ago, holding a spear in sweaty hands, standing on a forlorn and broken plate of rock surrounded by men in primitive clothing. They wore wraps of rough-spun lavis fibers and sandals of hogshide, and carried spears with bronze heads. Only the officer wore armor, a mere leather jerkin not even properly hardened. It had been cured, then cut roughly into the shape of a vest. It proved no help against an axe to the face. Dalinar roared, indistinctly remembering his first time in this vision. It had been one of the very earliest, when he still discounted them as nightmares. Today he intended to tease out its secrets. He charged the enemy, a group of men in similarly shoddy clothing. Dalinar's companions had backed themselves up to the edge of a cliff. If they didn't fight now, they'd be pushed off onto a steep incline that eventually ended in a sheer drop and a plummet of some 50 or 60 feet to the bottom of a valley. Dalinar rammed into the enemy group trying to push his men off the cliff. He wore the same clothing as the others, carried their weapons, but it brought one oddity. A pouch full of gemstones tucked at his waist. He gutted one enemy with his spear, then shoved the fellow toward the others. 30 or so men with ragged beards and callous eyes. Two tripped over their dying friend, which protected Dalinar's flank for a moment. He seized the fallen man's axe, then attacked to his left. The enemy resisted, howling. These men weren't well-trained, but any fool with a sharpened edge could be dangerous. Dalinar cut, slashed, laid about himself with the axe, which was well-balanced, a good weapon. He was confident he could beat this group. Two things went wrong. First, the other spearmen didn't support him. Nobody filled in behind to protect him from being surrounded. Second, the wild men didn't flinch. Dalinar had come to rely on the way soldiers pulled away when they saw him fighting. He depended on their discipline to fail. Even when he hadn't been a shardbearer, he'd counted on his ferocity, his sheer momentum, to win fights. Turned out the momentum of one man, no matter how skilled or determined, amounted to little when running into a stone wall. The men before him didn't bend, didn't panic, didn't so much as quiver as he killed four of them. They struck at him with increased ferocity. One even laughed. In a flash, his arm was chopped by an axe he didn't even see. Then he was shoved over by the rush of the attackers. Dalinar hit the ground, stunned, looking with disbelief at the stump of his left forearm. The pain seemed a disconnected thing, distant. Only a single pain spren, like a hand made of sinew, appeared by his knees. Dalinar felt a shattering, humbling sense of his own mortality. Was this what every veteran felt when he finally fell on the battlefield? This bizarre, surreal sense of both disbelief and long-buried resignation? Dalinar set his jaw, then used his good hand to pull free the leather strap he was using for a belt. Holding one end in his teeth, he wrapped it around the stump of his arm right above the elbow. The cut wasn't bleeding too badly yet. Took a moment for a wound like this to bleed. The body constricted blood flow at first. Storms, this blow had gone clean through. He reminded himself that this wasn't his actual flesh exposed to the air. That it wasn't his own bone there, like the center ring of a hunk of pork.
"Why not heal yourself as you did in the vision with Fen?" the Stormfather asked. "You have Stormlight."
"Cheating," Dalinar said with a grunt.
"Cheating,"
the Stormfather said.
"Why in damnation would that be cheating? You made no oath."
Dalinar smiled to hear a fragment of God cursing. He wondered if the Stormfather was picking up bad habits from him. Ignoring the pain as best he could, Dalinar seized his axe in one hand and stumbled to his feet. Ahead of him, his squad of 12 fought desperately, and poorly, against the frantic enemy assault. They'd backed right to the edge of the cliff. With the towering rock formations all around, this place almost felt like a chasm, though it was considerably more open. Dalinar wavered and almost collapsed again. "Storm it?"
"Just heal yourself," the Stormfather said. "I used to be able to shrug off things like this."
Dalinar looked down at his missing arm. "Well, perhaps nothing as bad as this."
"You're old," the Stormfather said.
"Maybe," Dalinar said, steadying himself, his vision clearing.
"But they made a mistake." "Which is?"
"They turned their backs on me." Dalinar charged again, wielding the axe in one hand. He dropped two of the enemy, punching through to his men.
Down! He shouted to them. We can't fight them up here. Skid down the incline to that ledge below. We'll try to find a way to climb down from there.
He jumped off the cliff and hit the incline in motion. It was a reckless maneuver, but storms they'd never survive up above. He slid down the stone, staying on his feet as he approached the sheer drop into the valley. A final small ledge of stone gave him a place to lurch to a stop. Other men slid down around him. He dropped his axe and seized one man, keeping him from falling all the way off the ledge to his doom. He missed two others. In all, seven men managed to stop around him. Dalinar puffed out, feeling lightheaded again, then looked down over the side of their current perch. At least 50 feet to the bottom of the canyon. His fellows were a broken, ragged group of men, bloodied and afraid. Exhaustion spren shot up nearby, like jets of dust. Above, the wild men clustered around the edge, looking down longingly, like axe hounds contemplating the food on the master's table.
Storms! The man Dalinar had saved slumped down. Storms! They're dead! Everyone's dead!
He wrapped his arms around himself. Looking about him, Dalinar counted only one man besides himself who had kept his weapon. The tourniquet he'd made was letting blood seep out.
We win this war, Dalinar said softly. Several others looked to him. We win. I've seen it. Our platoon is one of the last still fighting. While we may yet fall, the war itself is being won.
Above, a figure joined the wild men. A creature a good head taller than the others, with fearsome carapace armor of blackened red. Its eyes glowed a deep crimson.
Yes, Dalinar remembered that creature.
In this vision before, he'd been left for dead up above. This figure had walked past. A monster from a nightmare, he'd assumed, dredged from his subconscious, similar to the beings he fought on the Shattered Plains. Now he recognized the truth. That was a Voidbringer. But there had been no Everstorm in the past. The Stormfather confirmed that. So where had those things come from, back during this time?
Form up, Dalinar commanded. Get ready!
Two of the men listened, scrambling over to him. Honestly, 2 out of 7 was more than he'd expected. The cliff face shook as if something huge had struck it, and then the stones nearby rippled. Dalinar blinked. Was the blood loss causing his vision to waver? The stone face seemed to shimmer and undulate, like the surface of a pond that had been disturbed. Someone grabbed the rim of their ledge from below, a figure resplendent in shard plate, each piece visibly glowing an amber color at its edges despite the daylight, hauled itself onto their ledge. The imposing figure stood even larger than other men wearing shard plate.
Flee, the shard bearer commanded. Get your men to the healers. How? Dalinar asked. The cliff.
Dalinar started. The cliff had handholds now. The shard bearer pressed his hand against the incline leading up toward the Voidbringer, and again the stone seemed to writhe. Steps formed in the rock as if it were made of wax that could flow and be shaped. The shard-bearer extended his hand to the side, and a massive glowing hammer appeared there. He charged upward toward the Voidbringer. Dalinar felt the rock, which was firm to his touch. He shook his head, then ushered his men to start climbing down. The last one looked at the stump of his arm.
How are you going to follow, Malad?
I'll manage, Dalinar said.
Go.
The man left. Dalinar was growing more and more fuzzy-headed. Finally, he relented and drew in some stormlight. His arm regrew. First the cut healed, then the flesh expanded outward like a budding plant. In moments he wriggled his fingers, awed. He'd shrugged off a lost arm like a stubbed toe. The stormlight cleared his head and he took a deep, refreshed breath. The sounds of fighting came from above, but even craning his neck he couldn't see much, though a body did roll down the incline, then slip off the ledge.
Those are humans, Dalinar said. Obviously.
I never put it together before, Dalinar said. There were men who fought for the Voidbringers?
Some.
And that Shardbearer I saw, a herald?
No. Merely a stone ward. That surge that changed the stone is the other you may learn, though it may serve you differently.
Such a contrast. The regular soldiers looked so primitive, but that surge binder. With a shake of his head, Dalinar climbed down, using the handholds in the rock face. Dalinar spotted his fellows joining a large group of soldiers farther down the canyon. Shouts and whoops of joy echoed against the walls from that direction. It was as he vaguely remembered. The war had been won. Only pockets of the enemy still resisted. The larger bulk of the army was starting to celebrate.
All right, Dalinar said. Bring in Navani and Yasna.
He eventually planned to show this vision to the young emperor of Aesir, but first he wanted to prepare.
Put them somewhere close to me, please. Let them keep their own clothing.
Nearby, two men stopped in place. A mist of glowing stormlight obscured their forms, and when the mist faded, Navani and Yasna stood there, wearing habas. Dalinar jogged over to them.
Welcome to my madness, ladies.
Navani turned about, craning her neck to stare up at the tops of the castle-like rock formations. She glanced toward a group of soldiers who limped past, one man helping his wounded companion and calling for regrowth.
Storms, Navani whispered. It feels so real.
I did warn you, Dalinar said. Hopefully you don't look too ridiculous back in the rooms.
Though he had become familiar enough with the visions that his body no longer acted out what he was doing in them, that wouldn't be so for Yasna, Navani, or any of the monarchs he brought in. What is that woman doing? Yasna asked, curious. A younger woman met the limping men. A radiant? She had the look about her, though she wasn't armored. It was more her air of confidence, the way she settled them down and took something glowing from the pouch at her belt.
I remember this, Dalinar said. It's one of those devices I mentioned from another vision. The ones that provide regrowth, as they call it. Healing.
Navani's eyes widened and she beamed like a child who had been given a plateful of sweets for Middlefest. She gave Dalinar a quick hug, then hurried over to watch. She stepped right up to the side of the group, then waved impatiently for the radiant to continue. Yasna turned to look around the canyon.
I know of no place in our time of this description, Uncle. This seems like the Stormlands from those formations.
Maybe it's lost somewhere in the unclaimed hills?
That, or it's been so long the rock formations have weathered away completely.
She narrowed her eyes at a group of people who came through the canyon carrying water to the soldiers. Last time, Dalinar had stumbled down into the canyon just in time to meet them and get a drink.
You're needed above, one had told him, pointing up the shallow slope along the side of the canyon opposite where he had been fighting.
That clothing, Yasna said softly. Those weapons.
We've gone back to ancient times.
Yes, Uncle, Yasna said. But didn't you tell me this vision comes at the end of the desolations?
From what I remember of it, yes.
So the vision with the Midnight Essence happened before this, chronologically. Yet you saw steel, or at least iron, in that one. Remember the poker?
I'm not likely to forget.
He rubbed his chin.
Iron and steel then, but men wielding crude weapons here, of copper and bronze, as if they didn't know how to soul-cast iron, or at least not how to forge it properly, despite it being a later date.
Huh.
That is odd.
This is confirmation of what we've been told, but which I could never quite believe. The desolations were so terrible they destroyed learning and progress and left behind a broken people.
The Orders of Radiance were supposed to stop that, Dalinar said. I learned it in another vision.
Yes, I read that one. All of them, actually.
She looked to him then and smiled. People were always surprised to see emotion from Yasna, but Dalinar considered that unfair. She did smile. She merely reserved the expression for when it was most genuine. Thank you, Uncle, she said. You have given the world a grand gift. A man can be brave in facing down 100 enemies, but coming into these and recording them rather than hiding them was bravery on an entirely different level. It was mere stubbornness. I refused to believe I was mad.
Then I bless your stubbornness, Uncle.
Yasna pursed her lips in thought, then continued more softly.
I'm worried about you, Uncle. What people are saying.
You mean my heresy? Dalinar said.
I'm less worried about the heresy itself and more how you're dealing with the backlash.
Ahead of them, Navani had somehow bullied the Radiant into letting her look at the Fabriel. The day was stretching toward late afternoon, the canyon falling into shadow. But this vision was a long one, and he was content to wait upon Navani. He settled down on a rock.
I don't deny God, Yasna, he said. I simply believe that the being we call the Almighty was never actually God.
Which is the wise decision to make, considering the accounts of your visions?
Yasna settled down beside him.
You must be happy to hear me say that, he said.
I'm happy to have someone to talk to, and I'm certainly happy to see you on a journey of discovery. But am I happy to see you in pain? Am I happy to see you forced to abandon something you held dear?
She shook her head.
I don't mind people believing what works for them, Uncle. That's something nobody ever seems to understand. I have no stake in their beliefs. I don't need company to be confident.
How do you suffer it, Yasna? Dalinar said. The things people say about you. I see the lies in their eyes before they speak. Or they will tell me with utter sincerity things I have reportedly said, even though I deny them. They refuse my own word against the rumors about me.
Yasna stared out across the canyon. More men were gathering at the other end, a weak, beleaguered group who were only now discovering they were the victors in this contest. A large column of smoke rose in the distance, though he couldn't see the source.
I wish I had answers, Uncle, Yasna said softly. Fighting makes you strong, but also callous. I worry I have learned too much of the latter and not enough of the former. But I can give you a warning.
He looked toward her, raising his eyebrows.
They will try, Yasna said, to define you by something you are not. Don't let them. I can be a scholar, a woman, a historian, a radiant. People will still try to classify me by the thing that makes me an outsider. They want, ironically, the thing I don't do or believe to be the prime marker of my identity. I have always rejected that, and will continue to do so.
She reached over and put her free hand on his arm.
You are not a heretic, Dalinar Kullin. You are a king, a radiant, and a father. You are a man with complicated beliefs, who does not accept everything you are told. You decide how you are defined. Don't surrender that to them. They will gleefully take the chance to define you if you allow it.
Dalinar nodded slowly. Regardless, Yasna said, standing,
this is probably not the best occasion for such a conversation. I realize we can replay this vision at will, but the number of storms in which we can do it will be limited. I should be exploring.
Last time, I went that way, Dalinar said, pointing up the slope. I'd like to see what I saw again.
Excellent. We'd best split to cover more ground. I will go in the other direction, then we can meet afterward and compare notes.
She took off down the slope toward the largest gathering of men. Dalinar stood up and stretched, his earlier exertion still weighing on him. A short time later, Navani returned, mumbling explanations of what she'd seen under her breath. Teshev sat with her in the waking world and Kalami with Yasna, recording what they said, the only way to take notes in one of these visions. Navani took his arm in hers and looked after Yasna, a fond smile on her lips. No, none would think Yasna emotionless if they'd witnessed that tearful reunion between mother and daughter.
How did you ever mother that one? Dalinar asked.
Mostly without letting her realize she was being mothered,
Navani said. She pulled him close.
That Fabriel is wonderful, Dalinar. It's like a soul caster.
In what way?
In that I have no idea how it works. I think something is wrong with the way we've been viewing the ancient Fabriels.
He looked to her and she shook her head.
I can't explain yet.
Navani, he prodded.
No, she said stubbornly. I need to present my ideas to the scholars, see if what I'm thinking even makes sense, and then prepare a report. That's the short of it, Dalinar Kholin, so be patient.
I probably won't understand half of what you say anyway, he grumbled. He didn't immediately start them up in the direction he'd gone before. Last time, he'd been prompted by someone in the vision. He'd acted differently this time. Would the same prompting still come? He had to wait only a short time till an officer came running up to them.
You there, the man said. Malad Sunzent, isn't that your name? You're promoted to sergeant. Head to base camp 3.
He pointed up the incline.
Up over that knob there, down the other side. Hop to it!
He spared a frown for Navani. To his eyes, the two of them didn't belong standing in such a familial pose, but then charged off without another word. Dalinar smiled.
What?
Navani said.
These are set experiences that Honor wanted me to have. Though there's freedom in them, I suspect that the same information will be conveyed no matter what I do.
So, do you want to disobey?
Dalinar shook his head.
There are some things I need to see again. Now that I understand this vision is accurate, I know better questions to ask.
They started up the incline of smooth rock, walking arm in arm. Dalinar felt unexpected emotions start to churn within him, partially due to Jasnah's words. But this was something deeper, a welling of gratitude, relief, even love.
Dalinar?
Navani asked.
Are you well?
I'm just thinking, he said, trying to keep his voice even. Blood of my fathers. It's been nearly a half year, hasn't it, since all this started? All that time I came to these alone. It's just good to share the burden, Navani, to be able to show this to you, and to know for once, absolutely and certainly, that what I'm seeing isn't merely in my own mind.
She pulled him close again, walking with her head on his shoulder. Far more affectionate in public than Alethi propriety would sanction, but hadn't they thrown that out the window long ago? Besides, there was nobody to see. Nobody real, anyway. They crested the slope, then passed several blackened patches. What could burn rock like that? Other sections looked like they'd been broken by an impossible weight, while yet others had strangely shaped holes ripped in them. Navani stopped them beside a particular formation, only knee-high, where the rock rippled in a strange little symmetrical pattern. It looked like liquid, frozen mid-flow. Cries of pain echoed through these canyons and across the open plain of rock. Looking out over the ridge, Dalinar found the main battlefield. Stretching into the distance were corpses. Thousands of them, some in piles. Others slaughtered in heaps while pressed against walls of stone.
Stormfather,
Dalinar said, addressing the Spren.
This is what I told Jasnah it was, isn't it? Ahari Etiam? The last desolation? That is what it was called.
Include Navani in your responses, Dalinar requested.
Again you make demands of me. You should not do this,
the voice rumbled in the open air, and Navani jumped.
Ahari Etiam, Dalinar said. This isn't how songs and paintings depict the final defeat of the Voidbringers. In them, it's always some grand conflict with tremendous monsters clashing against brave lines of soldiers. Men lie in their poetry. Surely you know this. It just seems so like any other battlefield. And that rock behind you?
Dalinar turned toward it, then gasped, realizing something he'd mistaken for a boulder was actually a giant skeletal face. A mound of rubble they'd passed was actually one of those things he'd seen in a different vision. A stone monster that ripped its way out of the ground. Navani stepped up to it.
Where are the Parshmen?
Earlier I fought against humans, Dalinar said.
They were recruited to the other side, the Stormfather said. I think.
You think? Dalinar demanded.
During these days, honor still lived. I was not yet fully myself. More of a storm, less interested in men. His death changed me. My memory of that time is difficult to explain. But if you would see Parshmen, you need but look across that field.
Navani joined Dalinar at the ridge, looking out over the plain of corpses below.
Which ones?
Navani asked.
You can't tell?
Not from this distance.
Maybe half of those are what you'd call Parshmen.
Dalinar squinted, but still couldn't make out which were human and which were not. He led Navani down the ridge, then across a plain. Here the corpses intermingled. Men in their primitive clothing, Parshmen corpses that bled orange blood. This was a warning he should have recognized, but hadn't been able to put together his first time in the vision. He'd thought he was seeing a nightmare of their fight on the shattered plains. He knew the path to take, one that led him and Navani across the field of corpses, then into a shadowed recess beneath a tall, rocky spire. The light had caught on the rocks here, intriguing him. Before, he thought he'd wandered into this place by accident. But in truth, the entire vision had pointed him at this moment. Here they found 9 shard blades rammed into the stone. Abandoned. Navani put her gloved safe hand to her mouth at the sight. 9 beautiful blades, each a treasure, simply left here? Why and how? Dalinar stepped through the shadows, rounding the 9 blades. This was another image he'd misunderstood when living this vision the first time. These weren't just shard blades.
Ash's eyes, Navani said, pointing. I recognize that one, Dalinar. It's the one...
The one that killed Gavilar, Dalinar said, stopping beside the plainest blade, long and thin. The weapon of the White Assassin. It's an honor blade. They all are.
This is the day that the Heralds made their final ascension to the Tranquiline Halls, Navani said. To lead the battle there instead.
Dalinar turned to the side, to where he glimpsed the air shimmering. The Stormfather.
Only, Navani said, this wasn't actually the end. Because the enemy came back.
She walked around the ring of swords, then paused by an open spot in the circle.
Where is the 10th blade?
The stories are wrong, aren't they? Dalinar said to the Stormfather. We didn't defeat the enemy for good, as the Heralds claimed.
They lied.
Navani's head snapped up, her eyes focused on Dalinar.
I long blamed them, the Stormfather said, for their lack of honor. It is... difficult for me to look past oaths broken. I hated them. Now, the more I come to know men, the more I see honor in those poor creatures you name heralds.
Tell me what happened, Dalinar said.
What really happened? Are you ready for this story? There are parts you will not like.
If I've accepted that God is dead, I can accept the fall of his heralds. Navani settled down on a nearby stone, face pale.
It started with the creatures you name Voidbringers, the Stormfather said, voice rumbling and low, distant.
Introspective?
As I said, my view of these events is distorted. I do remember that once, long before the day you're seeing now, there were many souls of creatures who had been slain, angry and terrible. They had been given great power by the enemy, the one called Odium. That was the beginning, the start of desolations. For when these died, they refused to pass on.
That's what's happening now, Dalinar said. The Parshmen. They're transformed by these things in the Everstorm. Those things are... He swallowed. The souls of their dead?
They are the spren of Parshmen long dead. They are their kings, their light eyes, their valiant soldiers from long, long ago. The process is not easy on them. Some of these spren are mere forces now, animalistic, fragments of minds given power by Odium. Others are more awake. Each rebirth further injures their minds. They are reborn using the bodies of Parshmen to become the Fused. And even before the Fused learned to command the Surges, men could not fight them. Humans could never win when the creatures they killed were reborn each time they were slain. And so the Oath Pact.
10 people, Dalinar said. 5 male, 5 female. He looked at the swords. They stopped this?
They gave themselves up. As Odium is sealed by the powers of honor and cultivation, your heralds sealed the spren of the dead into the place you call damnation. The heralds went to honor and he gave them this rite, this oath. They thought it would end the war forever, but they were wrong. Honor was wrong.
He was like a spren himself, Dalinar said. You told me before. Odium, too.
Honor let the power blind him to the truth, that while spren and gods cannot break their oaths, men can and will. The 10 heralds were sealed upon damnation, trapping the Voidbringers there. However, if any one of the 10 agreed to bend his oath and let Voidbringers past, it opened a flood. They could all return.
And that started a desolation, Dalinar said.
That started a desolation, the Stormfather agreed.
An oath that could be bent, a pact that could be undermined. Dalinar could see what had happened. It seemed so obvious. They were tortured, weren't they?
Horribly. By the spirits they trapped. They could share the pain because of their bond. But eventually someone always yielded. Once one broke, all 10 heralds returned to Roshar. They fought. They led men. Their oath pact delayed the Fused from returning immediately, but each time after a desolation, the heralds returned to damnation to seal the enemy again, to hide, fight, and finally withstand together. The cycle repeated. At first, the respite between desolations was long, hundreds of years. Near the end, desolations came separated by fewer than 10 years. There was less than 1 year between the last two. The souls of the heralds had worn thin. They broke almost as soon as they were caught and tortured in damnation.
Which explains why things look so bad this time, Navani whispered from her seat. Society had suffered desolation after desolation, separated by short intervals. Culture, technology, all broken. Dalinar knelt and rubbed her shoulder. It is not so bad as I feared, she said. The heralds, they were honorable. Perhaps not as divine, but I may even like them more, to know they were once just normal men and women.
They were broken people, the Stormfather said. but I can start to forgive them and their shattered oaths. It makes sense to me now, as it never did before.
He sounded surprised.
The Voidbringers who did this, Navani said. They are the ones that are returning now. Again.
The fused, the souls of the dead from long ago, they loathe you. They are not rational. They have become permeated with his essence, the essence of pure hatred. They will see this world destroyed in order to destroy mankind. And yes, they have returned.
Ahariatium, Dalinar said,
was not really the end. It was just another desolation.
Except something changed for the heralds. They left their swords?
After each desolation, the heralds returned to damnation, the Stormfather said. If they died in the fighting, they went there automatically, and those who survived went back willingly at the end. They had been warned that if any lingered, it could lead to disaster. Besides, they needed to be together in damnation, to share the burden of torture if one was captured. But this time, an oddity occurred. Through cowardice or luck, they avoided death. None were killed in battle, except one.
Dalinar looked to the open spot in the ring.
The Nine realized, the Stormfather said, that one of them had never broken. Each of the others at some point had been the one to give in, to start the desolation to escape the pain. They determined that perhaps they didn't all need to return. They decided to stay here, risking an eternal desolation, but hoping that the one they left in damnation would alone be enough to hold it all together. The one who wasn't meant to have joined them in the first place. The one who was not a king, scholar, or general.
Telenalot, Dalinar said.
The bearer of agonies, the one abandoned in damnation, left to withstand the tortures alone.
Almighty above, Navani whispered. How long has it been? Over 1,000 years, right?
4,500 years, the Stormfather said. 4,500 millennia of torture.
Silence settled over the little alcove, which was adorned with silvery blades and lengthening shadows. Dalinar, feeling weak, sat down on the ground beside Navani's rock. He stared at those blades and felt a sudden irrational hatred for the heralds. It was foolish. As Navani had said, they were heroes. They'd spared humanity the assaults for great swathes of time, paying with their own sanity. Still, he hated them, for the man they had left behind. The man... Dalinar leaped to his feet.
It's him!
He shouted.
The madman! He really is a herald!
He finally broke, the Stormfather said. He has joined the Nine who still live. In these millennia, none have ever died and returned to damnation, but it doesn't matter as it once did. The Oath Pact has been weakened almost to annihilation, and Odium has created his own storm. The Fused do not return to damnation when killed. They are reborn in the next Everstorm.
Storms? How could they defeat that?
Dalinar looked again at that empty spot among the swords.
The madman, the herald. He came to Kolinar with a shard blade. Shouldn't that have been his honor blade?
Yes, but the one delivered to you is not it. I do not know what happened.
I need to speak with him. He was at the monastery when we marched, wasn't he?
Dalinar needed to ask the Ardens to see who had evacuated the madmen.
Is this what caused the Radiance to rebel?
Navani asked.
Are these secrets what sparked the recreants?
No, that is a deeper secret, one I will not speak.
Why? Delinar demanded.
Because were you to know it, you would abandon your oaths as the ancient Radiance did.
I wouldn't?
Wouldn't you?
The Stormfather demanded, his voice growing louder.
Would you swear it? Swear upon an unknown? These heralds swore they would hold back the Voidbringers, and what happened to them? There is not a man alive who has not broken an oath, Delinar Kolin. Your new Radiance hold in their hands the souls and lives of my children. No, I will not let you do as your predecessors did. You know the important parts. The rest is irrelevant.
Delinar drew in a deep breath, but contained his anger. In a way, the Stormfather was right. He couldn't know how this secret would affect him or his Radiance. He'd still rather know it. He felt as if he were walking about with a headsman following, planning to claim his life at any moment. He sighed as Navani stood and walked to him, taking his arm.
I'll need to try to do sketches from memory of each of those honor blades, or better send Shallan to do it. Perhaps we can use the drawings to locate the others.
A shadow moved to the entrance to this little alcove, and a moment later a young man stumbled in. He was pale of skin, with strange wide shin eyes and brown hair that had a curl to it. He could have been one of any number of shin men Delinar had seen in his own time. They were still ethnically distinct, despite the passing of millennia. The man fell to his knees before the wonder of the abandoned honor blades. But a moment later, the man looked to Delinar and then spoke with the Almighty's voice.
Unite them.
Was there nothing you could do for the heralds? Delinar asked. Was there nothing their god could do to prevent this? The Almighty, of course, couldn't answer. He had died fighting this thing they faced, the force known as Odium. He had, in a way, given his own life to the same cause as the heralds. The vision faded.
Folio, the Vorin Hava. Though fashion elites in Leofor have presented more daring designs in past folios, they've found there is no quicker way to influence Alethian Vaden styles than through subtle changes over time in the traditional Vorin Hava.
39. Notes. No good can come of two shards settling in one location. It was agreed that we would not interfere with one another, and it disappoints me that so few of the shards have kept to this original agreement. Shallan can take notes for us, Yasna said. Shallan looked up from her notebook. She'd settled against the tile-covered wall, sitting on the floor in her blue hava, and had intended to spend the meeting doing sketches. It had been over a week since her recovery and subsequent meeting with Yasna at the Crystal Pillar. Shallan was feeling better and better, and at the same time less and less like herself. What a surreal experience it was, following Yasna around as if nothing had changed. Today Delinar had called a meeting of his Radiance, and Yasna had suggested the basement rooms of the tower because they were so well secured. She was incredibly worried about being spied upon. The rose of dust had been removed from the library floor. Navani's flock of scholars had carefully catalogued every splinter. The emptiness served only to underscore the absence of the information they'd hoped to find. Now everyone was looking at her. Notes? Shallan asked. She'd barely been following the conversation. We could call for brightness, Teshov. So far it was a small group. The Blackthorn, Navani, and their core surge binders, Yasna, Renarin, Shallan, and Kaladin Stormblessed, the flying bridgeman. Adolin and Elokar were away, visiting Vaidenar to survey the military capacities of Terravangian's army. Malato was working the oath gate for them. No need to call in another scribe, Yasna said. We covered shorthand in your training, Shallan. I'd see how well you've retained the skill. Be fastidious. We will need to report to my brother what we determine here. The rest of them had settled into a group of chairs except for Kaladin, who stood leaning against the wall, looming like a thundercloud. He had killed Helleran, her brother. The emotion of that peaked out, but Shallan smothered it, stuffing it into the back of her mind. Kaladin wasn't to be blamed for that. He'd just been defending his Bright Lord. She stood up, feeling like a chastened child. The weight of their stares prodded her to walk over and take a seat beside Yasna, with her pad open and pencil ready. So, Kaladin said, according to the Stormfather, not only is the Almighty dead, but he condemned 10 people to an eternity of torture. We call them heralds, and they're not only traitors to their oaths, they're probably also mad. We had one of them in our custody, likely the maddest of the lot, but we lost him in the turmoil of getting everyone to Urethiru. In short, everyone who might have been able to help us is crazy, dead, a traitor, or some combination of the three. He folded his arms. Figures. Yasna glanced at Shallan. She sighed, then recorded a summary of what he'd said, even though it was already a summary. So what do we do with this knowledge? Renarin said, leaning forward with his hands clasped. We must curb the Voidbringer assault, Yasna said. We can't let them secure too great a foothold. The Parshmen aren't our enemies, Kaladin said softly. Shallan glanced at him. There was something about that wavy dark hair, that grim expression. Always serious, always solemn, and so tense, like he had to be strict with himself to contain his passion. Of course there are enemies, Yasna said. They're in the process of conquering the world. Even if your report indicates they aren't as immediately destructive as we feared, they are still an enormous threat. They just want to live better lives, Kaladin said. I can believe, Yasna said, that the common Parshmen have such a simple motive. But their leaders? They will pursue our extinction. Agreed, Navani said. They were born out of a twisted thirst to destroy humankind. The Parshmen are the key, Yasna said, shuffling through some pages of notes. Looking over what you discovered, it seems that all Parshmen can bond with ordinary Spren as part of their natural life cycle. What we've been calling Voidbringers are instead a combination of a Parshmen with some kind of hostile Spren or spirit. The Fused, Dalinar said. Great, Kaladin said. Fine. Let's fight them, then. Why do the common folk have to get crushed in the process? Perhaps, Yasna said, you should visit my uncle's vision and see for yourself the consequences of a soft heart. First-hand witness of a desolation might change your perspective. I've seen war, Brightness. I'm a soldier. Problem is, ideals have expanded my focus. I can't help but see the common men among the enemy. They're not monsters. Dalinar raised a hand to stop Yasna's reply. Your concern does you credit, Captain, Dalinar said. And your reports have been exceptionally timely. Do you honestly see a chance for an accommodation here? I don't know, sir. Even the common Parshmen are furious at what was done to them. I can't afford to stay my hand from war, Dalinar said. Everything you say is right, but it is also nothing new. I have never gone to battle where some poor fools on either side, men who didn't want to be there in the first place, weren't going to bear the brunt of the pain. Maybe, Kaladin said, that should make you reconsider those other wars, rather than using them to justify this one. Shallan's breath caught. It didn't seem the sort of thing you said to the Blackthorn.
Would that it were so simple, Captain.
Dalinar sighed loudly, looking weathered to Shallan.
Let me say this. If we can be certain of one thing, it is the morality of defending our homeland. I don't ask you to go to war idly, but I will ask you to protect. Alethkar is besieged. The men doing it might be innocents, but they are controlled by those who are evil.
Kaladin nodded slowly.
The king has asked my help in opening the Oath Gate. I've agreed to give it to him. Once we secure our homeland, Dalinar said, I promise to do something I'd never have contemplated before hearing your reports. I'll seek to negotiate. I'll see if there is some way out of this that doesn't involve smashing our armies together.
Negotiate? Yasna said. Uncle, these creatures are crafty, ancient, and angry. They spent millennia torturing the heralds just to return and seek our destruction.
We'll see, Dalinar said. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to contact anyone in the city with the visions. The Stormfather has found Kolinar to be a dark spot to him.
Navani nodded.
That seems, unfortunately, to coordinate with the failure of the Span Reeds in the city. Captain Kaladin's report confirms what our last notes from the city said. The enemy is mobilizing for an assault on the capital. We can't know what the city's status will be once our strike force arrives. You might have to infiltrate an occupied city, Captain.
Please send that it isn't so, Renarin whispered, eyes down. How many would have died on those walls, fighting nightmares?
We need more information, Yasna said. Captain Kaladin, how many people can you take with you to Alethkar?
I plan to fly at the front of a storm, Kaladin said, like I did returning to Urethiru. It's a bumpy ride, but maybe I can fly over the top of the winds. I need to test it. Anyway, I think I could bring a small group.
You won't need a large force, Dalinar said. You, a few of your best squires. I'd send Adolin with you too, so you have another shard bearer in an emergency. Six, perhaps. You, three of your men, the king, Adolin. Get past the enemy, sneak into the palace, and activate the Oath Gate.
Pardon if this is out of line, Kaladin said. But Elokar himself is the odd one. Why not just send me and Adolin? The king will probably slow us down.
The king needs to go, for personal reasons. Will there be a problem between you?
I'll do what is right, regardless of my feelings, sir. And I might be beyond those feelings anyway now.
This is too small, Yasna mumbled. Shallan started, then glanced at her.
Too small?
Not ambitious enough, Yasna said more firmly. By the Stormfather's explanation, the Fused are immortal. Nothing stops their rebirth now that the Heralds have failed. This is our real problem. Our enemy has a near-endless supply of parchment bodies to inhabit, and judging by what the good captain has confirmed through experience, these Fused can access some kind of surge binding. How do we fight against that?
Shallan looked up from her notepad, glancing toward the others in the room. Renarin still leaned forward, hands clasped, eyes on the floor. Navani and Dalinar were sharing a look. Kaladin continued to lean against the wall, arms folded, but he shifted his posture, uncomfortable.
Well, Dalinar finally said, we'll have to take this one goal at a time. First, Kolinar.
Pardon, Uncle, Yasna said. While I don't disagree with that first step, now is not the time to think only of the immediate future. If we are to avoid a desolation that breaks society, then we'll need to use the past as our guide and make a plan.
She's right, Renarin whispered. We're facing something that killed the Almighty himself. We fight terrors that break the minds of men and ruin their souls. We can't think small.
He ran his hands through his hair, which was marked by less yellow than his brother's.
Almighty, we have to think big. But can we take it all in without going mad ourselves?
Dalinar took a deep breath.
Yasna, you have a suggestion of where to start this plan?
Yes. The answer is obvious. We need to find the heralds. Kaladin nodded in agreement. Then, Yasna added, we need to kill them.
What? Kaladin demanded. Woman, are you insane?
The Stormfather laid it out, Yasna said, unperturbed. The heralds made a pact. When they died, their souls traveled to damnation and trapped the spirits of the Voidbringers, preventing them from returning.
Yeah, then the heralds were tortured until they broke.
The Stormfather said their pact was weakened, but did not say it was destroyed, Yasna said. I suggest that we at least see if one of them is willing to return to damnation. Perhaps they can still prevent the spirits of the enemy from being reborn. It's either that, or we completely exterminate the Parshmen so that the enemy has no hosts. She met Kaladin's eyes. In the face of such an atrocity, I would consider the sacrifice of one or more heralds to be a small price.
Storms! Kaladin said, standing up straight. Have you no sympathy?
I have plenty, Bridgeman. Fortunately, I temper it with logic. Perhaps you should consider acquiring some at a future date.
Listen, Brightness, Kaladin began.
Enough, Captain,
Dalinar said. He gave Yasna a glance. Both fell quiet. Yasna without so much as a peep. Shallan had never seen her respond to someone with the respect she gave Dalinar.
Yasna, Dalinar said. Even if the Pact of the Heralds still holds, we can't know that they'd stay in damnation, or the mechanics for locking away the Voidbringers there. That said, locating them seems like an excellent first step. They must know much that can greatly assist us. I will leave it to you, Yasna, to plan out how to accomplish that.
What of the Unmade? Renarin said. There will be others, like the creature we found down here.
Navani has been researching them, Dalinar said.
We need to go even farther, Uncle, Yasna said. We need to watch the movements of the Voidbringers. Our only hope is to defeat their armies so soundly that even if their leaders are constantly reborn, they lack the manpower to overwhelm us.
Protecting Alethkar, Kaladin said. Doesn't have to mean completely crushing the Parshmen, and
if you wish, Captain, Yasna snapped. I can get you some mink kits to cuddle while the adults plan. None of us want to talk about this, but that does not make it any less inevitable.
I'd love that, Kaladin responded. In turn, I'll get you some eels to cuddle. You'll feel right at home.
Yasna curiously smiled. Let me ask this, Captain. Do you think ignoring the movement of Voidbringer troops would be wise?
Probably not, he admitted.
And do you think, perhaps, that you could train your squire windrunners to fly up high and scout for us? If span reeds are proving unreliable these days, we'll need another method of watching the enemy. I'd happily cuddle sky eels as you offer, if your team would be willing to spend some time imitating them. Kaladin looked to Dalinar, who nodded appreciatively.
Excellent, Yasna said.
Uncle, your coalition of monarchs is a superb idea. We need to pen the enemy in and prevent them from overrunning all of Roshar. If... She trailed off. Shallan paused, looking at the doodle she'd been doing. Actually, it was a bit more complex than a doodle. It was kind of a full sketch of Kaladin's face, with passionate eyes and a determined expression. Yasna had noticed a creation spren in the form of a small gemstone that had appeared on the top of her page, and Shallan blushed, shooing it away.
Perhaps, Yasna said, glancing at Shallan's sketchbook.
We could do with a short break, Uncle.
"If you wish," he said. "I could use something to drink."
They broke up, Dalinar and Navani chatting softly as they went to check with the guards and servants in the main hallway. Shallan watched them go with a sense of longing as she felt Yasna loom over her.
"Let us chat," Yasna said, nodding toward the far end of the long rectangular room.
Shallan sighed, closed her notebook, and followed Yasna to the other end, near a pattern of tiles on the wall. This far from the spheres brought for the meeting, the lighting was dim.
"May I?" Yasna said, holding out her hand for Shallan's notebook.
She relinquished it.
"A fine depiction of the young captain," Yasna said. "I see 3 lines of notes here, after you were pointedly instructed to take the minutes. We should have sent for a scribe. We had a scribe.
To take notes is not a lowly task, Shallan. It is a service you can provide."
"If it's not a lowly task," Shallan said, "then perhaps you should have done it."
Yasna closed the sketch pad and fixed Shallan with a calm, level stare.